You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Flashpoints.
This is Guns and Butter.
Something happening, yeah. Yeah, yeah. What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there.
Yeah, that's right.
I'm Bonnie Faulkner. Today on Guns and Butter is a live show here at KPFA. This is the last week of the KPFA Fun Drive, and I'm delighted to be here live. Unusual for me to drive down today. I'm also excited because I'm joined by Guns and Butter co-producer Tony Rango. Welcome, Tony.
Thanks, Bonnie. Appreciate it.
Yeah, good to have you on again. We're going to be hearing a lot from Tony about the new Guns and Butter website and other developments. I did want to take a moment before we go to the first cut of our incredible premium. We're bringing you Barbara Honecker on her research into the Pentagon on 9/11. Very, very good stuff. Very thorough. But I wanted to mention that I have had, over the past 2 months, terrible technical audio engineering problems with the show, which probably many listeners have noticed. I've had to play some reruns. I've gotten some new equipment, have to get some more. Yarrow's still working out the kinks, but we're back on the road again, and I'm looking forward to some great new shows. And, of course, Tony Rango's going to be helping me with that as a co-producer. Tony, did you want to say a couple of words about the Guns and Butter website?
Sure. Thanks, Bonnie. Well, as your technical issues arose, we launched your website during that time, and you can go to gunsandbutter.org to check it out. It's got some great features such as blogging. We're going to be doing some conversations, and you certainly can also follow us on Twitter, and we've got a SoundCloud site where we've got about half your archive shows already up, so you can go check them out there.
Great job, Tony. You know, I've been hoping and praying for some help, and now I finally have some. So anyway, we're real excited to be here to support KPFA, to support the Fun Drive on Guns and Butter, and we're hoping that you will too. We're bringing you first a 20-minute cut from an incredible 3-hour DVD, Behind the Smoke Curtain, What Happened at the Pentagon on 9/11, What Didn't and Why It Matters, with Barbara Honecker. You know, Barbara Honecker has quite a history. She was part of the Reagan administration. She worked for Reagan's domestic policy advisor. Her office was right above the Oval Office. She was the first one from the Reagan administration to resign as a matter of conscience because of the treatment of women's rights. She went on to write October Surprise, which covered the Iran side of Iran-Contra. And then, of course, for many years, she's been a very dedicated 9/11 activist with a specialty in the Pentagon. So, Jill, how about let's play that first cut from Behind the Smoke Curtain.
The title of my talk is Behind the Smoke Curtain. The alternative title for my talk is Or Everything You Think You Probably Know About the Pentagon Attack Is Wrong. So, what happened at the Pentagon and didn't, and why it matters so terribly much for our future. 1 year before 9/11, on September 11th, the year 2000, the neocon organization that called themselves Project for a New American Century, or you may have heard the acronym PNAC or PNAC, actually called in one of their publications for a new Pearl Harbor. This famous quote is from the Project for New American Century Manifesto from page 51. Quote, "The process of transformation, even if it brings revolutionary change, is likely to be a long one, absent some catastrophic and catalyzing event like a new Pearl Harbor," unquote. As the Project for New American Century Manifesto was being published, this offer was made to producer Aaron Russo a full year before 9/11. In September of 2000, Nicholas Rockefeller, of the Rockefeller family who built the Twin Towers, told Russo, quote, "There's going to be an event, and out of that event, we're going to invade Afghanistan." so we can run pipelines through the Caspian Sea, so we can go into Iraq, so we can take the oil, so we can establish bases in the Middle East to make the Middle East part of the New World Order. And then he says, in my relationships with some of these people, the Rockefellers, the Council on Foreign Relations, etc., in my relationship with some of these people, I can tell you that is as evil as it gets. That's Aaron Russo. If he joined them, Russo was told, he would, quote, be spared the police state measures, the domestic surveillance state measures, that would be imposed on the rest of the American public, that means you, after, quote, the event, unquote, happened. This is a year before 9/11. And you can see this statement by Aaron Russo on a video on the net. The Project for New American Century neocons prepared the ground for 9/11 so it would be seen as a surprise attack, which it wasn't, and for the chorus of Pearl Harbor, Pearl Harbor, New Pearl Harbor on September 11th. In the months leading up to the 9/11 attacks, Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld gave out literally hundreds, if not thousands, of copies of neocon Roberta Wohlstetter's 1962 book on Pearl Harbor, a book which pushed the false surprise attack and intelligence failures official line of the original Pearl Harbor attack. She was the wife of neocon godfather, who was Deputy Secretary of Defense Wolfowitz's personal mentor, Richard Pearl's father-in-law, and Zionist passionate war hawk Albert Wohlstetter. The movie Pearl Harbor hit theaters in late May of 2001 using real Navy ships that were arranged with the Navy by the Navy's man in Hollywood, who was on deck to assure so-called historical accuracy and pyrotechnic special effect. Only an attack on an iconic national military facility, however, could give them their new Pearl Harbor. Just think about it. Even though on 9/11 the World Trade Center attacks were more spectacular, for sure, and they were the first attacks of World Trade Center Towers 1 and 2, they would have been likely seen, in my opinion, as just a very much bigger World Trade Center 93 or a much bigger Oklahoma City. But both of those attacks had already been handled by the civilian courts. And these people did not want the 9/11 attacks to be viewed as a bigger Oklahoma City or a bigger World Trade Center 93. They wanted them to be viewed as a new Pearl Harbor, which required an attack on something like the iconic military facility at Pearl Harbor, and that iconic military facility was the Pentagon. Only the Pentagon attack made 9/11 into the new Pearl Harbor that the authors of the PNAC manifesto wanted and needed to roll out their global domination agenda. They needed it to claim justification for endless preemptive wars, which we are still in over 11 years later, for their global domination agenda. And most people don't know, point three, for the creation shortly after 9/11 of the first U.S. mainland combatant command. It's called NORTHCOM. And what that means is, if you recall, that the Bush-Cheney administration very much wanted and said that the entire world, meaning including the mainland United States, your homeland, was now part of the global battlefield. And in order to make it literally a battlefield, they had to, for the first time, create a combatant command over mainland United States called NORTHCOM. It also enabled the new Pearl Harbor attack on the Pentagon, in addition, of course, to the other attacks of 9/11, but it was the key one, is what I'm arguing, enabled the Bush-Cheney administration to bypass on 9/11 and before 9/11, there was joint authority over NORAD's response, over the jets that were so late in responding to all of the attacks on 9/11. It took an hour and 15 minutes, which was absurd. On and before 9/11, the decisions as to NORAD responses were actually the joint authority of the U.S. President and the Canadian Prime Minister. So once NORTHCOM was created, they separated out the decision-making, the unilateral decision-making authority of the U.S. President over those kinds of responses. Also, of course, the 9/11, and in particular, the Pentagon made it into the new Pearl Harbor, justified, they claimed, their domestic surveillance state that we are still within. And they enabled Bush Jr., President George W. Bush, to continually evoke Article 2 of the Constitution, his so-called commander-in-chief powers, which he did and members of his administration did over and over repeatedly to justify violation of our Bill of Rights, of U.S. federal law, of international law, and even Nuremberg principles. Bush even said that it was the Pentagon attack that made it war in his mind, and a new Pearl Harbor. In his memoir, which has been published, his book, and in his speeches after his memoir was published, he said that it was after the World Trade Center 1 hit, he thought it was due to it just being a terrible pilot. That is an accident. He said in print that when he was told of the second hit, presumably we are told when Andrew Card whispered in his ear, America's under attack, even then he didn't think we were at war. Not per se. He said in his memoirs and his speeches after his memoirs were published that it was with the Pentagon attack that he knew we were at war. And you had to be able to sell to the American public and the world that we were at war in order to justify all these horrendous actions in the name of the 9/11 lie. Bush wrote in his diary on September 11th, quote, "The Pearl Harbor of the 21st century took place today," unquote. Because the Pentagon attack had, therefore, to succeed, to affect us being at war, to affect the new Pearl Harbor, and to get their global domination agenda and surveillance state, they couldn't rely upon mere hijackers, no matter who they were, even if there were any. They had to control the operation. And in order to control it, they had to execute it, and only pre-placed explosives, both at the World Trade Center, as David Ray Griffin and Richard Gage and Niels Harrit and Professor Stephen Jones and many others have proven, is the real story at the World Trade Center, both World Trade Center's Towers 1 and 2, with planes, plane approaches and impacts, as the mere cover cause, so that it would be apparent that the buildings came down to the uninitiated because of the planes' impacts and the fires. The same, as you will see from this presentation, is true at the Pentagon. That the real story at the Pentagon is pre-placed inside the building explosives with a plane approach and destruction as the cover cause. To get their new Pearl Harbor, the Project for New American Century neocon signatories, in order to be certain that they had it, they had to steal the 2000 election. And they did that in Florida, where Bush's brother was governor, Jeb Bush. A Project for New American Century signatory. Bush v. Gore was argued by none other than Ted Olson, whose wife Barbara's, we now know, non-existent alleged cell phone calls from the alleged Pentagon plane Flight 77 were the source, the most important source for the claim that the alleged Pentagon plane hijacker story, that there were hijackers on that plane. And without that story, there is zero evidence that Flight 77 even returned east, even if it was Flight 77, as you'll see, that left Dulles Airport to begin with. And the entire official story of the Pentagon attack falls apart. And in case you question that the cell phone calls of Barbara Olson from Flight 77 have been deemed non-existent, that is now the official position of the FBI in the Massawi trial of the Pentagon and of American Airlines. It's per David Ray Griffin. Bush planned on being a, quote, war president, unquote, before he even ran for the office of president. He said so. With Bush's election, the Project for New American Century signatories then became the U.S. government. You will see that in the next slide, which I will not be able to read because it goes on and on in fine print forever, of all the PNAC signatories and participants. There were two levels, signatories and participants, who actually became the United States government. Once in power, however, only the Pentagon attack guaranteed Bush and the Project for New American Century signatory and participants, Bush becoming a war president, and they're getting their new Pearl Harbor to roll out their global domination and domestic surveillance state agenda. This will be in my book, all of this. But following the theft of the 2000 election, and by the way, Bush v. Gore was decided by the Supreme Court completely unconstitutionally, because the Constitution makes explicitly clear that in the case of a contested presidential election, that the House of Representatives makes the decision, not the Supreme Court. So following this after the 2000 election, the Project for New American Century Manifesto, signatories and participants literally became the U.S. government uniquely, with the motive, means, opportunity, and access to effect their new Pearl Harbor in the attacks of 9/11. And what you could barely see here are, this is name after name after name of the individuals who were PNAC manifesto signatories and participants, and their absolutely top positions in the federal government once the election was stolen. Only the Pentagon attack enabled We Are at War, which you notice this is from immediately after 9/11. This is the National Security Agency, NSA, General Zahner, who is the head of their Signals Intelligence Directorate. And they apparently expected something to happen because they whipped out this We Are at War immediately after the attacks. Zahner was in charge of the NSA unit that surveilled calls to and from, and I put Al-Qaeda in quotes, Al-Qaeda's global communications center in Yemen for a minimum of a year and a half before 9/11. They knew exactly what was coming down. The new Pearl Harbor and war memes were pushed by the mainstream media as the attacks were literally in progress, before either of the towers fell in New York, and they were smoking. This is just one example, but there are dozens. As the attacks were unfolding, the BBC in London began playing clips from Pearl Harbor. Tom Brokaw, NBC Today show, as the attacks were unfolding in New York, said, "There's been a declaration of war by terrorists. This is the most serious attack on the U.S. since Pearl Harbor." Time magazine, in its special September 2001 9/11 issue, said, quote, "What's needed in response to 9/11 is a unified, unifying Pearl Harbor sort of purple American fury, a ruthless indignation that doesn't leak away in just a week or two," unquote. Pearl Harbor was mentioned, war was mentioned by the mainstream media. 9/11 was clearly designed using the original Pearl Harbor attacks as its template. So what did the new Pearl Harbor insider script require the appearance of in the actual execution of the attacks of 9/11? They had to appear to be surprise attacks. They had to appear to be kamikaze pilot attacks, with planes this time used as weapons on buildings instead of ships. Both the original Pearl Harbor and 9/11 attacks were in the morning. There needed to be a critical mass of innocent deaths. The next slide after this one is truly chilling. Condoleezza Rice, the National Security Advisor, and Bush both said immediately after the attacks they just couldn't imagine planes having ever been used as weapons in a kamikaze-like attack. Well, she isn't a historian, and a kamikaze attack triggered U.S. participation in World War II. It is, I simply can't imagine that Condoleezza Rice couldn't imagine. And Condoleezza Rice and Philip Zelikow, who became the executive director of the 911 Commission cover-up inquiry, and I put inquiry in quotes, were members of Bush Sr.'s A-team when he was president. They had co-published a book, They served on, as I mentioned, Bush Sr.'s National Security Council together, and Zelikow became her top aide plenipotentiary at the State Department when she moved to the State Department. And Zelikow, not surprisingly, in his own bio, states that he is an expert on creating public myths, you can read that as lies, and maintaining public presumptions about those lies, and call that cover-ups. He, Zelikow, was effectively the sole author of the 9/11 Commission report. He wrote its detailed outline before this so-called investigation even began, and Zelikow authored the Bush Doctrine for Unilateral Preemptive War under Condoleezza Rice at the State Department. I also interviewed Richard Clark, who was the so-called counterterrorism czar in the Bush Jr. Cheney White House. I interviewed him when I was at the Naval Postgraduate School, and he told me in an article that was actually, I published it on a DOD website online, that, quote, the White House approved all major exercise scenarios in advance. Now, the White House can only mean the National Security Council. And our Vice President Cheney. And the National Security Council was headed by Condoleezza Rice, and the counterterrorism czar was Mr. Clark himself. So what does that mean? I was the original researcher who uncovered the reality of and the importance of as the modus operandi for the planning, execution, and cover-up of the real inside perpetrator attack of 9/11, that at the center of that were military exercises that were taking place on the morning of 9/11 itself that were on hijack scenarios. So what we're saying here is that Richard Clark himself, the White House counterterrorism czar before and on 9/11, told me personally, and I have published it on a DOD website, that he and Condoleezza Rice knew of and pre-approved the hijack scenario exercises taking place before and on 9/11. To succeed, the real inside job 9/11 PSYOP required a critical mass of innocent deaths. Believe it or not, after the World Trade Center attack in 1993 that killed, I believe, 5 people and injured about 1,000, federal agents were heard to say by reporter Stephen Emerson that, quote, there had not been enough deaths this time. After the 1993 World Trade Center attacks, also, most people don't know this, but the World Trade Center tower's roof doors were locked, ordered locked, by official New York City policy. So that on 9/11, it happened, because of that, that the innocent victims above the impact zones were trapped, terrorized, and killed. They had no way to escape except to jump. And even the New York Times published that I believe 105 victims had gotten right up to the door, where in 1993 they were able to go onto the roof, but they were blocked. Also, after the impacts and before the towers fell, dozens of military and civilian helicopters self-dispatched, wonderful people from the military, started flying towards New York City, intending to rescue survivors from the towers, to risk their lives in their helicopters. They were ordered to go to a nearby military base so that they could not respond. On 9/11, 2 World Trade Center tower attacks, 15 minutes apart, of course, ensured the maximum PSYOP, ensured this maximum live audience for the second World Trade Center hit and the towers collapse. After the 9/11 attacks, Paul Wolfowitz, who was a top signatory and participant in the Project for New American Century manifesto, published exactly a year before 9/11, and was Deputy Secretary of Defense on 9/11, immediately under Donald Rumsfeld at the Pentagon, he actually had this to say about the critical mass of deaths in the 9/11 attacks. This is after 9/11 now. He predicted, before the final numbers were in, that the 9/11 attacks would soon be found to have resulted in a, quote, greater number of American deaths than any single day in U.S. history since the Civil War, more than any single day in World War I and World War II. and that Americans would now be willing to sacrifice their lives in great numbers for the cause of defeating terrorism, the so-called global war on terrorism. And quoted Winston Churchill, quote, America is like a great boiler. Once it gets fired up, the energy it generates is enormous. This was then echoed by Newsweek magazine immediately after, quote, more people were killed by the alleged suicide hijackers last week than the number of American soldiers killed in the entire American Revolution or at Antietam, the bloodiest one-day battle of the Civil War, or at Pearl Harbor, or on D-Day. And locking the roof doors ensured that. But none of any of this would have succeeded without the Pentagon attack. So, proving its official story a lie, as Richard Gage and David Ray Griffin and so many others have proven for the World Trade Center attacks, to prove that the Pentagon attack official story is a lie is so extremely important.
That's the voice of Barbara Honecker, very heavy material. We have just played you the first 20 minutes of a three-hour DVD. This is a presentation that Barb gave up in Seattle a couple of years ago, 3 hours long. She gives an incredible PowerPoint presentation, lots of graphics, lots of pictures, and you can follow along with everything she says because the DVD is so well produced. It's called Behind the Smoke Curtain, What Happened at the Pentagon on 9/11, What Didn't and Why It Matters. Barbara Honecker, 3 hours long. This is our thank you gift today on Guns and Butter for a tax-deductible donation to KPFA of $100. $100, and we would be delighted to provide you with this information research-packed 3-hour DVD Behind the Smoke Curtain. If you'd like to donate to KPFA today on Guns and Butter, please give us a call at 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. Of course, you can always pledge securely online at kpfa.org. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. Of course, this is Guns and Butter. I'm here live in the studio, delighted to be joined by my co-producer on Guns and Butter, Tony Rango. Hi there, Tony.
Thanks, Bonnie. Nice to be here.
Wonderful to have you on board. You know, it's so wonderful to get some help. I'm oftentimes in here all alone, and it's certainly it's better for the audience too if there's two people in here. 1-800-439-5732. $100 Behind the Smoke Curtain is yours. A blockbuster 3-hour DVD. Barbara Honecker covers it all, everything with regard to 9/11, and specifically the Pentagon. Tony, you know, I thought we might say a little bit something about the Guns and Butter website before we go back.
We can jump into that. Before we get to that, I thought I would let folks know I was just on the Amazon site about this movie, and it's full of 5-star ratings, including Bonnie's got one on there, a good quote from herself. But some really amazing stuff out there that people are saying about this movie. Blew my mind with their new film was this piece of one quote that I'm reading here. So it's really important that folks check this out.
Yeah, you know, Tony, I had forgotten that I had written a review of it, and when Tony said to me, look at the reviews on Amazon, and I went in there and I looked at mine and I thought, oh, I like mine the best. So what I wrote about it is the most comprehensive, penetrating, and courageous presentation on the September 11th Pentagon attacks that I have seen. The presentation covers it all, beginning with the planning for a new American century by the neocons and Zionists, including a new Pearl Harbor to launch perpetual war and the setting up of a domestic police state, the seizure of power through the stolen 2000 presidential election, detailed and verified proof that the official Pentagon story is a lie, media complicity with the perpetrators beginning before, during, and after the event, what really happened, evidence for pre-placed explosives, evidence of the real perpetrators, the philosophical underpinnings of the masterminds. This is a riveting 3 hours, including graphics, photographs, and point-by-point slides. A must-see blockbuster. Highly recommend it. That's my review of this incredible gift. You can get this wonderful DVD and at the same time support KPFA by giving us a call at 1-800-439-5732, securely online at kpfa.org. Tony?
Yeah, we'd like to thank the pledge coming in from San Jose that recently came in. We'd like to thank you very much for that. And we should maybe talk a little about the website that we've launched. And
Tony. Tony's been busy on the website. You know, everybody for years has been saying to me, Bonnie, why don't you get your website back up? Well, people think that that's a snap. It's not so easy. So what's going on with that, Tony?
So there's a website at gunsandbutter.org. And from there, you can find archives. And we're putting up we recently sent out a newsletter to a bunch of your folks in your mail list and put a little information about that and the new SoundCloud site that's got, I think, about 165 of your shows already posted with well over 7,000 listens and downloads. So people are finding it, whether they're your listeners or just people on SoundCloud. And then also an active Twitter feed that's posting things from the blog. I definitely encourage you to check out the latest blog. It's some pretty powerful stuff out there that we put up last night. So please go gunsandbutter.org to check it out and call in on this this video.
Yeah, thanks, Tony. And I've been checking out the blog. You have to, it's a drop down menu. Go to the blog. Tony's come up with some great articles. So that's a real resource, gunsandbutter.org. But right now, back to the business at hand. This is a fund drive for KPFA here on Guns and Butter. We're offering Behind the Smoke Curtain, What Happened at the Pentagon on 9/11, What Didn't, and Why It Matters with Barbara Honecker. 3 hours long, riveting. It's heavy stuff, but boy, she has done the research. She's got the evidence. You can hear it. You can see it. $100 pledge to KPFA, 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. $100 for this incredible 3-hour DVD. And then, of course, you are helping KPFA at the same time. A $25 donation makes you a voting member of KPFA and the Pacifica Foundation. So please, if you already have Behind the Smoke Curtain or you can't afford it, $25 goes a long way. You know, our old election supervisor, Les Radke, bless him, used to say that if everybody listening to KPFA out there donated $25, we wouldn't even need to have fund drives. So those $25 pledges are very important. If you want to be a member, you need to donate now. Don't wait. 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-439-5732, kpfa.org. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. Of course, this is Guns and Butter, and I'm joined by co-producer Tony Rango. Thank you for coming in, Tony. What do you think, Jill? Shall we start that second clip of Behind the Smoke Curtain with Barbara Honecker on the Pentagon attacks on 9/11?
Now, the official story also claims that Flight 77, a large Boeing 757, coming in very low at approximately 540 to 560 miles per hour, hit 5 light poles in a row, there they are, without exploding. But a 757 could not have hit one light pole, according to an expert I'm about to quote for you, let alone 5 in a row, and even made it to the wall without exploding. Why? Because the official story means that a 757, Flight 77 or otherwise, would had to have had still 11,250 gallons of flammable jet fuel in its wing tanks. Most people don't know, I certainly didn't until I did this research, that the largest, or two of the large, almost as large as the center fuselage tank, this is a graphic from Boeing's own website of its 757 200 series, which is what Flight 77 was. And this is flammable material, the jet fuel that is located in the two wing tanks, including tanks off to the wake tips. And experts have told me, including Ralph Kolstad, who flew this very plane, he was very clear that the fuel in the center Hunter or fuselage body tank is used up first. And the official story says that Flight 77 or A-757 went out and turned around and came back. And before it hit the Pentagon, it was only out for an hour and 17 minutes. And it would have used the fuel from the center fuselage tank. And the tanks in the wings would have been flying fuel bombs. And the official story says that the leading edge of those two wings that are filled with still with fuel, according to the official story, hit five 240-pound light poles like this in a row. When the impact, I found this wonderful image of a single flying bird does this to a wing. And here's an example of what a single flying goose does to the lightweight carbon fiber nose of a plane. And as I mentioned, I interviewed Ralph Kolstadt, the Top Gun Navy pilot who flew the physical plane. It was Flight 77 on 9/11. He said, if a 757 hit a light pole going at that high speed, it would rip open the wing, rip open the fuel tank in the wing. That wing would erupt into flames. The wings and probably the entire plane with it would have been destroyed before it could ever get to the building. When a leading edge of a wing of this jet hit just a single light pole, it sheared the wing entirely off, spilled jet fuel and wreckage over 100 feet, and crashed the plane to the ground. When the same thing happened to a large airliner, now that plane was smaller than a 757, but when the same kind of thing happened to a large airliner like Flight 77, which was in Detroit in 1987, 18 feet sheared off the left wing, which is the one that hit the light pole, when it hit two light poles, going at only 222 miles per hour, which was less than half the reported 540 to 560 miles per hour that Flight 77 was allegedly going when it allegedly hit five light poles in a row. And no wings or large wing pieces like this were found anywhere at or in the Pentagon. And even if Flight 77 or any large airliner had gotten through the light pole and tall 6-foot-high spools obstacle course, a plane couldn't have penetrated, I do not believe, the evidence shows, the newly hardened outer wall of the Pentagon. Wedge One's outer wall, which you see a graphic to the right from the Pentagon Building Performance Report, how the wall had been hardened after the Oklahoma City bombings. The Pentagon decided that they wanted to harden all of its outer walls to prevent that kind of an attack on the Pentagon. And Wedge One's outer wall, which includes where the official story says Flight 77 allegedly hit, had just been newly hardened to withstand terrorist attacks, specifically the kind that the official story says happened on 9/11. Now, this very much parallels, doesn't it, the World Trade Centers? Because we know that the World Trade Center Towers 1 and 2 were specifically designed to withstand the impact of a plane like the official story says hit those buildings on 9/11. Same thing with the Pentagon in just that wedge. Interesting, isn't it? 2 feet thick after the upgrade, steel and Kevlar mesh. So the entire wall was like a huge bomb and plane-proof vest. This is what happened to the nose of a large airliner when it hit a non-reinforced wall. Unlike the hardened wall of the Pentagon on 9/11, far thinner than the Pentagon's wall, going at a mere fraction of the speed, I believe it was 88 miles per hour, claimed for Flight 77. To summarize this part, the official story at the Pentagon on 9/11 claims that after striking five light poles in a row, the leading edge of the wings, and somehow making it through the newly hardened wall that was specifically re-engineered to withstand just such a terrorist attack as at the World Trade Center, without its full wing fuel tanks exploding, which Ralph Cole said would have happened, a 757, according to the official story, then finally did explode, but only after it was almost entirely inside the building. And that this is the official story now, that once inside the building, after being progressively shredded and dispersed over 285 feet, going in at a diagonal 45-degree angle, that it turned into a quasi-liquid unexploded fuel and debris slurry, and that slurry somehow magically reconstituted itself after going around all of these still standing columns into a perfectly focused cone of energy, which somehow magically cut this almost perfectly round alleged exit hole in the C-ring wall. Despite there being, according to Duane Dietz, former NASA Director of Research Engineering, did an analysis of this slide from the Pentagon Building Performance Report. He has shown that there isn't a single path between the official story alleged entrance point or impact point of Flight 77 and the alleged exit hole in the C-ring that does not have multiple still-standing columns in the way that would have dispersed this alleged quasi-liquid flurry. The FBI's official 911 investigation code name is PENT BOMB. It's not PENT PLANE. And this stands for, officially, Pentagon Twin Towers Bombing. The FBI actually lied outright to one of the Jersey girls who had lost their husbands in the World Trade Center towers on 9/11, telling them that, quote, all of its investigation abbreviations end in bomb. This is a lie. The anthrax investigation, for instance, which is, of course, related to 9/11, does not. It is codenamed by the FBI Amerithrax, not Ameribomb. And as well, codenames for investigations known to be about bombings do end in bomb. For example, the Oklahoma City bombing investigation is codenamed Oak Bomb. So it should tell us something that the FBI's codename for the entire 9/11 investigation is PENT BOMB. That it was the code name of the entire 9/11 investigation was reconfirmed by the FBI's own director, Robert Mueller, in 2011. The terrorist hunter, this is the cover image on that issue, which was right after the alleged killing of Osama bin Laden. FBI Director Mueller to Time Magazine, May 10th, 2011. Quote, the FBI's Strategic Intelligence Operations Center filled to capacity on September 11th and remained that way through PENT BOMB. The FBI's, this is still part of the director's quote, the FBI's cryptonym for Pentagon, Twin Towers, and bombing. The official story states there were no bombs at the Pentagon, that there were no bombs at the World Trade Center, that there were no pre-placed explosives, nanothermite or otherwise, at the World Trade Center or at the Pentagon. The FBI knows otherwise. The real story at the Pentagon, just as at the World Trade Center, is pre-placed explosives. Additional evidence for inside the building primary explosions at the Pentagon, similar to what you already know about pre-placed inside explosives at the World Trade Centers 1, 2, and 7. Evidence that the Wedge 1 collapse, Wedge 1 again, the official story place of the alleged impact of Flight 77, evidence of the Wedge 1 collapse over the alleged plane penetration damage path on the inside of the building was in fact due to explosives. I'm about to give you that evidence, including possibly thermite. These are images on the top of the Oklahoma City Murrah Federal Building after it was known to have been destroyed by inside bombs as well as an outside truck bomb, but we know that there were at least four internal bombs in addition to the cover story outside rider truck bomb. And then at the bottom is the Pentagon after collapse of the section of Wedge 1 over the alleged impact point of Flight 77, using Al-Qaeda hijackers as the cover story. Witnesses to the sounds of a series of explosions also in the Pentagon use almost identical language to World Trade Center firefighters describing the going off of pre-placed controlled demolition explosives. So here are just some of these witnesses. Lieutenant McCowan, first floor D-ring in the Naval Command Center of the Pentagon on 9/11. Quote, it sounded like a series of explosions going off, a series of bombs exploding, similar to like firecrackers when you light them and you just get that series going off. Again, identical language to the description of firefighters from the Nod A Brothers video of the World Trade Center saying they went off like firecrackers coming down. Lieutenant Colonel Thurman, second floor D-ring of the Pentagon on 9/11. To me, it didn't seem like a plane. To me, it seemed like it was a bomb. Being in the military, I've been around grenade and artillery explosions. In other words, he's been around bombs. It was a two-part explosion to me. It seemed like there was a percussion blast that blew me kind of backwards in my cubicle to the side, and then it seemed as if a massive explosion went off at the same time. This is a photograph from the Pentagon Building Performance Report of what's inside the columns of the West Wedge. These are reinforced steel supports. In fact, a massive explosion happened at just the time of the collapse of the outer wall over the alleged plane impact point, which is yet further evidence that another internal explosion caused that collapse. This is a live video clip from the Pentagon that morning. Note the time on the clip of 10:10 a.m.
That's the voice of Barbara Honecker. You're listening to the, the beginning of the second 20-minute clip from our pledge item today on Guns and Butter, Behind the Smoke Curtain, what happened at the Pentagon on 9/11, what didn't, and why it matters. 3 hours, 3-hour-long DVDs. It's an incredible presentation, PowerPoint, pictures, graphs. You can follow along with her for 3 solid hours. She covers it all. Meticulous research. It's very riveting. And she concludes this DVD with the perpetrators. Behind the Smoke Curtain, our pledge item to you today for a tax-deductible donation to KPFA Radio. Give us a call, 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-439-5732. Of course, I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. I do want to thank a few people who have called in. We're getting a good response. There's Chris Dates up in Healdsburg. Hey, Chris, thanks a lot. He's a big supporter of KPFA. I'd also like to thank John Angus from Boulder Creek, California. Thank you, John. Also, a big thanks to Leah Monterosa in San Francisco. Also, thank you to Eric Nilsson in Sebastopol. You can join these supporters of Guns and Butter and KPFA by giving us a call at 1-800-439-5732. $100 for the DVD, $25 makes you a member. Hey, Tony, it looks like we just got a match.
Very nice.
Okay, we got a $900 match. There's some encouragement from Dave in Berkeley, Anonymous in Oakland, and Susan from Inverness. $900 match on Guns and Butter today. Give us a call, 1-800-439-5732. That makes your money go twice as far. What have you got there, Tony?
I've got a few thank yous as well. Judy Boston from Concord, Tony and Mary Jackson from Merced, David McFarland from Sonoma, David Van Giesen from Santa Rosa, and Rhonda Lewis from Fresno. Thank you, guys.
All right, Tony. 1-800-439-5732. $100 tax-deductible donation to KPFA Behind the Smoke Curtain. What happened at the Pentagon on 9/11? What didn't? And why it matters. A 3-hour-long DVD. Or you can pledge securely online at KPFA.org. We've got a match of $900, so thank all of you for helping us bring it in for KPFA today on the, the third of the last day of the spring fun drive. Well, Tony, what else is going on with Guns and Butter? Now, we're up and running with a lot of new stuff.
We are, and as we mentioned, there's some newsletters going out. We sent one a couple of weeks ago to sort of announce the site and things like that, and we mainly sent it to your address book and some people who had subscribed already. And another one's about to go out tonight, and it's going to go to your address book, and it's going to ask you if you want to be on the mailing list, you'll need to opt in, so meaning you'll need to sign up at the newsletter, which at the bottom of every page you can join, and it basically wants you to reconfirm with your email. Some of these mail services, they don't want a lot of spam going out, so they want to make sure you actually want to subscribe. So you'll get the instructions on the email if you're on the Bonnie's address book and some of the contacts that she's had, and if not, we'll please go to the website and join the newsletter so that you can receive all future updates. To join the newsletter, it's free.
Right. Thank you, Tony. And, of course, that's gunsandbutter.org. But, of course, right now you need to call 1-800-439-5732 to support this spring fund drive here on KPFA. You can pledge online at kpfa.org or call 1-800-439-5732. We've gotten a very good response so far. We've got a $900 pledge, so we need some more calls to make that pledge. We've got 10 minutes to go. Behind the Smoke Curtain, what happened at the Pentagon on 9/11 and what didn't and why it matters with Barbara Honecker. I'm telling you, she covers, I don't know how to say it. I mean, she covers everything about the Pentagon. The light, you heard the stuff about the light poles. It was always claimed that, of course, a 757 hit the, if it was a 757, I'm getting my planes mixed up, hit the Pentagon because the light poles fell down. Well, Barbara shows that the fuel is in the wings and, it wouldn't be able to smash through light poles. She goes on to explain the columns within the Pentagon are still standing in the path of what is officially claimed as the path of the plane entering the building. But the columns, a lot of the columns are still there. Then very interesting stuff about what goes on the inner rings, people talking about explosions, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. She deconstructs some of the controversial eyewitness testimony. I'm telling you, it's 3 hours jam-packed. And at the very end, she takes questions from the audience. So there's some Q&A at the end, and that's quite lively. That's Barbara Honecker, Behind the Smoke Curtain, What Happened at the Pentagon on 9/11, What Didn't, Why It Matters. Our thank you gift today for a pledge to KPFA of $100, 1-800-439-5732. We're in a match period of $900. What have you got there, Tony?
I've got a few more thank yous. Mel Rosenthal from Oakland, David Walker from San Francisco, Peter Gill from Berkeley, and Karen Stern from Berkeley.
Oh, how nice. And thank you, Karen. And these are some people I know. This is wonderful because sometimes at public events, you know, I get to meet the listeners. Karen's a great. That's really nice. Thank you so much for those pledges. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. $25 makes you a member and enables you to vote in KPFA local station board. Very important to be involved in the governance of Pacifica. 1-800-439-5732. $25 makes you a member. $100, we'd be delighted to send you Barb Honecker's Behind the Smoke Curtain, 3 hours long. 1-800-439-5732. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. Of course, this is Guns and Butter, if you just tuned in. I'm joined by Guns and Butter co-producer Tony Rango. And I'm wondering, is there anything else we need? What else is going on the Guns and Butter website, Tony?
Well, you should probably check out the campaigns, Bonnie. This is something that you and I kicked around and kicked off last night, was to raise some funds. One of the things we want to try and do is get to the Electric Universe Conference coming up next month, to where we can attend and interview some speakers there and get some of those published on the Guns or Butter website and out on the air for listeners.
Yes, and if you're not familiar with the Electric Universe, which most people are not, this is cutting-edge science. And that that conference is going to take place in late June. What is their website? Thunderbolts.com?
Thunderbolts.info.
.info, that's right, right. .info. One of the people, actually, that Tony introduced me to, turned me on to, and we did an hour-long interview with him on Guns and Butter, Ben Davidson, The Other Side of Climate Change. He is going to be one of many featured speakers at the Electric Universe. So Tony and I are hoping to go to that, interview people, record audio, and bring that back to you. So any help you can give us doing that is very much appreciated. Thank you, Tony. And Tony's getting this stuff up on the website. I can't do this.
No problem, Bonnie.
So thank you, Tony. 1-800-439-5732, $100. We can, KPFA would be delighted to send you Barb Honecker's information-packed, research-packed presentation, Behind the Smoke Curtain, What Happened at the Pentagon on 9/11, What Didn't, and Why It Matters. $100 for that. $25 makes you a member, but you've got to make that call. We've got, oh my goodness, we've only got 5-6 minutes left, 6 minutes to go. 1-800-439-5732. We're in a match period. Three people have put up a very generous match of $900. Dave in Berkeley, anonymous in Oakland, and Susan from Inverness. 1-800-439-5732. What have you got? You've got some more pledges there, Tony?
Couple more. David from San Jose, thank you. That looks like Ron Martell from El Cerrito and Jerry Foster from Santa Rosa.
All right. Thank you. You can join all of these great supporters of KPFA and Guns and Butter at 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. 5732. You know, on the back of Barbara's DVD, there is a list of comments by some very top-level 9/11 researchers showing their support for her research. Quote, this will transform the discussion of what happened on 9/11. That from Professor David Ray Griffin. Richard Gage, of course, who Guns and Butter listeners are very familiar with, the founder of Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth, says, this presentation blew me away. Okay. Then we've got Professor Niels Herit, quote, I think you're the only Pentagon researcher who is both honest and presents a coherent model. There's a quote from Annie Michon, former MI5 British intelligence. I met her, very nice person. Well done on an excellent presentation. And on and on, Dr. Tim Eastman, a PhD plasma physicist. Actually, he worked with my friend, the late Todd Fletcher, on the Pentagon. Tim Eastman, a plasma physicist, says, quote, you've done a great job and an outstanding service to the 9/11 truth community and to our country, tirelessly separating the wheat from the chaff on the Pentagon question. We are all extremely grateful for this. Well, I'm grateful for it, too, because the Pentagon has been the most controversial subject with regard to the alternative 9/11 research. So kudos to Barbara Honecker for putting it all together. You know, when she retired or resigned from her job, she's dedicated herself full time to 9/11 research. Behind the smoke curtain, what happened at the Pentagon on 9/11, what didn't, why it matters. Barbara Honecker, 3 hours long. Our gift to you today for $100, 1-800-439-5732, $100 for the DVD. We want to get some of those $25 pledges in here, too, for those of you who are not members, who want to become members and vote in our governance election. 1-800-439-5732. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. I'm joined by co-producer Tony Rango. Well, Tony, any final thoughts? Anything we haven't mentioned about the website?
No, I think we've covered most of it. Just a kind of a quick rundown again. Make sure you give us your email at the bottom of any page for the newsletter so that you can stay informed about Guns and Butter. Go to SoundCloud, check it out. You can follow, share, and like there. Follow us on Twitter and stay informed, and do check out the blog. And please do comment. We want to hear your feedback. It's a great way. And also, we've got a contact form on there. If you have suggestions or anything like that, we'll be getting back to you shortly.
Well, exactly. And, of course, it's very important if you want to stay on our mailing list that you have to actually, what, Tony, sign up? Is that it?
Right. You have to put your email in, and then it'll send you an email. It's sort of, it's called a double opt-in confirm. You put your email, and then you confirm via your email.
Well, they don't make it easy, do they?
No.
I've got a couple more people to thank. Mel Douglas in Concord. Thanks, Mel. He called in and pledged today. Don Moore in San Francisco. Thank you, Dawn. You can join these two people and all the other people who have called. 1-800-439-5732. $100 for this incredible DVD. I'm telling you, you're not going to regret it. This thing is packed. And when I say packed, I mean packed with information, analysis, research, charts. You can follow along step by step with Barbara. It's very clear, and there's a lot there, and there's Q&A at the end, and she even goes into the perpetrators at the very end of Behind the Smoke Curtain, what happened at the Pentagon on 9/11, what didn't, and why it matters. Please send me an email at faulkner@gunsandbutter.org. That's F-A-U-L-K-N-E-R at gunsandbutter.org. Of course, we're on Twitter. That's what, Tony? G&B Radio?
That's correct. Or you can find it from the website as well.
Yes, yes. We've got our Twitter feed up there on the website, kind of the way Webster Tarpley does it. We saw that. It looked pretty good, so we're trying that out. And, of course, there's a lot more to come on the website. Tony's busy at work on that. I got to hand it to Tony. He's got the energy. Looks like we made our match, Tony.
Excellent. Thank you all.
Thank you. We made that $900 match. I want to thank you all so very, very much for all your great support for Guns and Butter and for KPFA. I want to welcome Jill Montgomery back. Hey, thanks a lot, Jill. Lovely to see you. Thank you so much.
something happening, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap. Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
New World Notes.
Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. In the holiday spirit, we present Almost Complete and Almost Uncut, Scooter's Satiric Collage, The War on Christmas Kickstarter. I hope you'll stay tuned. Last year, about this time, we broadcast an installment titled Dispatches from the War on Christmas. That show included about 10 minutes of an audio collage on the same theme by Scooter. Scooter produces a satiric radio program, The Inner Side, down at KPFT-FM in Houston. You may recall one part we broadcast, a funny war movie parody which ends with Alvin and the Chipmunks getting machine-gunned to death by enemy forces. Well, I recall it. I think that Scooter's collage is worth hearing in its entirety, and today we shall hear almost all of it, almost uncut and almost unabridged. In addition to the Chipmunk Massacre, the piece has parts of a debate on religion in America. The debate is between that most articulate pundit and, incidentally, atheist, the late Christopher Hitchens, and a guy named Bill Donahue. Donahue sees the Roman Catholic Church as under attack by the evil forces of secular humanism. Hitchens makes short work of him. And the collage includes much, much more, including a couple of Christmas carols in the musical style technically known as heavy metal. The War on Christmas Kickstarter. Kickstarter is now an obscure metaphor based on obsolete technology, a term of obscure origin and perhaps vague meaning to you youngins, like fast forward and the flip side. I'm old enough to have owned and operated actual Kickstarters, as well as fast-forward buttons and discs that had a flip side. Well, from hour to hour we ripe and ripe, and hour to hour we rot and rot, and thereby hangs a tale. But let us turn from Shakespeare to the War on Christmas Kickstarter. I hope you'll get a kick out of it.
It's that time of year. We've pooped out the last of that Thanksgiving turkey. And you know what that means, my precious godless heathens. Time to gather up your pentagrams, dead babies, and evil, satanic Harry Potter action figures. Because the truce is over. Tonight, the eternal War on Christmas resumes.
Celebrate the horror of Christmas with the most violent holiday special ever.
Gee, this is awful, Dad. Claude loaded on dope and he's killing people.
Tell it to the Xmas bunny, kid.
Cute, isn't it? Santa Claus bring up for Christmas? I got a fire engine.
Listen, Mug. Do you know who I am?
Now, don't tell me. Are you animal or vegetable? Animal.
All aboard!
We are free and fairly sober with so many toys to build. The machines are kind of tricky, probably someone will be killed. But we gladly work for nothing,
which is good because we don't intend to pay.
The elves are back to work today.
Hooray!
We have just a couple hours to make several billion gifts, and the labor isn't easy.
Then you'll all want triple shifts. You can make the job go quicker if you turn up the controls to super speed.
It's back to work on Xmas Eve.
Hooray! And though your coat is sore and ugly, your pride will mask the pain.
Let my happy smile warm your heart.
There's a toy lodged in my brain. We are getting awfully tired and we can't work any faster and we're very, very sorry.
Selfish little bastards, do you want the kids to think that Santa's just a crummy, empty-handed jerk?
Yeah.
Then shut your yaps and back to work.
Silent night, holy night, lost asleep, one so light, just the faithful and holy pair. Lovely boy child with curly hair, sleep in heavenly peace, sleep in heavenly peace.
My mother must have gotten a Miss Shields. There could be no other explanation.
You'll shoot your eye out! You'll shoot your eye out!
You'll shoot your eye out, kid.
Merry Christmas. Ho, ho, ho.
Okay, well, what else is there to tell? Not much, you know. I don't know where to start with the rest of it. Which is probably for the best, because I don't know when to stop either. It's, you know, it's like beat a dead horse. Hell, I'll nuke this son of a bitch and then complain because the meat is overdone.
And American retailers really rely on it for the bulk of their earnings.
You're anti-Christmas.
It was a war on Christmas to sell everything, from Coca-Cola to electric shavers. It goes on and on.
The war.
Happy reunion between tradition, war faith, war business, and just war fun. War is Santa making a comeback. War. Christmas time is a lot of fun.
War on Christmas. The true meaning of Christmas is Christ's birthday.
War.
Christ's birthday.
Secular progressives. Why Christmas matters.
War.
That is the subject of this evening's Talking Points memo. War under assault by secular progressives. They want a new America.
and inclusive America. Secular progressives don't want Christmas because that stands in the way of legalized drugs, euthanasia, gay marriage,
What about the movie Dogma, also coming out from Miramax? You're not going to see a movie about Kaddish. You're not going to see a movie where they're going to use toilet humor with the Jews. That's because Jews have done a better job than Catholics have in fighting back. Catholics are a little slow to react. Now, the public sector, that's what I want to talk about. The public sector actually subsidizes anti-Catholicism in this country. You wouldn't have the Rockefeller Foundation subsidizing Jews for Jesus, but you have the Ford Foundation subsidizing Catholics for a free choice, which was condemned by the Catholic Church in 1993. The nonprofits, you have Sisters of Perpetual Indulgence, dressed like nuns. People say, well, they give money to charities. How about a bunch of white boys setting up the Al Jolson Society with a little black paint on their face, doing a little tap dance and saying, well, we give to charities. In terms of the public theaters, Manhattan Theater Club, the museums, the Brooklyn Museum of Art. Let's listen to the reaction here. Boxes of maggots, decomposing cow's heads, bisected pig in formaldehyde, and the Holy Virgin Mary by Christopoulos. Where did this come from? Well, it came from England. There are two things about England that I know that we've had to put up with. One of them is Christopher Hitchens, and the other is elephant dung. You may need this, too. After listening to him, I brought along some of my vomit bags. Now, we used that very successfully in the Brooklyn Museum of Art. So if anybody feels the need to puke, there you have. Now, you also have a problem with the state schools in this country. Penn State, for example, feminist fascists there, made a vagina with human hair and then put our Blessed Mother inside of it to show how much they care about us. At Hunter College, another state-supported institution, you had Condom Jesus, and at SUNY New Paltz, the same kind of outrage.
Now, it could be that when religion is attacked in this country, that the Catholic Church comes in for a little more than its fair share. But doesn't the Catholic Church make rather large claims for itself? The Catholic Church claims to hold the keys of Peter. The Holy Father claims to have that power and to be the vicar of Christ upon earth. It is said that only through this means and this approach can redemption be achieved. These are large claims for a human and fallible and political and bureaucratic institution to be making for itself in the age of Hawking. I think it's also the case that America is preeminently a country of, if not sexual license, a country of sexual tolerance, a country of sexual pluralism, for now. Well, Holy Mother Church doesn't settle for that. Holy Mother Church makes rather strict demands. Holy Mother Church prohibits, by various edicts, ukases, statutes and pronouncements, all forms of sex that are not specifically devoted to the outcome of procreating further Catholics, and it enforces this with a celibate hierarchy. Now, that's fine, and it is your choice, and as you say, no one has to join that church, but that church, where it can, does try and impose those standards on non-believers and non-members. And should it not be believed, or at least affirmed, or at any rate not repudiated, that you should expect to suffer for this? That you should be proud to be abused? That you will be told that what you believe is absurd? That you should be glad to hear it for his sake? And isn't that a rather dignified position? A rather honorable position for the church to take? But instead, what do we get? An endless whine of self-pity. Of, well, why are they picking on us? They wouldn't say that about the Jews. An endless play on the ethnic politics and identity politics card. An endless appeal to self-pity, where you should be proud that you're in a fight for your politics and your church. And you seem instead to be resentful about it, and perhaps, who knows, a little insecure. However, for the main part of it, you only have to open a paper to see the exaggerated deference paid to every utterance of His Holiness the Pope, wherever he goes, and the extraordinary deference shown to him whenever he visits these shores and decides to grace us with his presence. As I say, I have only a minute to go, and I don't want to overrun my time or end foaming in mid-sentence, waving vomit bags and Tampax in the name of good taste and good bearing and good manners and good standards. I think I can hope to be rescued from that fate without any divine intercession. The truth of the matter is, ladies and gentlemen, comrades and friends, brothers and sisters, religion has it very much its own way in this country of ours. It's in the Pledge of Allegiance, thanks to a stupid intervention by President Eisenhower. It's on the money. It's in the opening of Congress every day. It's at the National Prayer Breakfast. It's when the delinquent president summons his advisors and his spiritual team in order to fend off what should have been inevitable. And it's high time that that situation was reversed and we developed a proper immunity to it and made sure that religion could only be self-inflicted. Thank you. Bring us a figgy pudding, so bring us a figgy pudding. Bring us a figgy pudding and a cup of good cheer. We won't go until we get some. We won't go until we get some. We won't go until we get some. So bring it out here.
You say that Calcutta needs population control. But on the page before, you actually say that secular leftist politics predominates. Didn't you quite figure out the cause and effect? Didn't you quite figure out that the reason they have so much poverty over there is precisely because of your secular leftist politics which predominates? Where in God's name has socialism ever delivered anything but what Orwell said? Leader worship, oppression, and war. That's the legacy of what you stand for.
Yeah.
everybody knows that there is one way, that and only one way, by which poverty can be cured. It involves the empowerment of women. Go to a village in Bolivia, in Bangladesh, anywhere you like, any wooden spoon country you choose. Give women some power and education where their reproduction and reproductive rate is concerned, and come back a year or two later, and you will see the floor has moved up a little bit away from the swamp of ignorance and filth and superstition and infant mortality and disease, and things are starting to happen. And then if you can come up with maybe a handful of seeds in a small loan, things will really start to happen. But it all depends on releasing women from their dependence on the cycle of reproduction and on the husbands who force it on them and the conditions that force it on them.
She's to be examined and executed by Joseph.
And lords are leaping.
And the community on the spot. What would be the natural
consequence?
Knew she was going to be killed if her condition became known.
Up there, six geese are laying.
It would be sin. It would be regret. It would be sorrow. It would be shame. There would be tears. There would be secrecy. There would be seclusion. She would run and hide and try to save her life. So what did Mary do?
It's been a war. It's been just war on Christmas.
She ran all right. She ran straight to the house.
And was a leaping.
Christmas. There is a war on Christmas.
Your auntie was a war on Christmas.
And then all the community would join in until Mary was
born. War.
Secular progressives don't want Christmas because that stands in the way of
at ease, gentlemen. Welcome to the new cavalry. We will ride into battle.
All right, you chipmunks. Ready to sing your song?
I'll say we are. Yeah, let's sing it now.
Okay, Simon?
This is Norton Scooter Presents, a Norton Scooter production. Me, your host, Norton Scooter, reporting from the surge, or the bulge, or the escalation, or whatever the kids are calling it these days.
You don't have to catch it. You don't have to beat it. But I can assure you, out of the plane.
And as you can probably tell from what's going on behind me, the war on Christmas has been fully mobilized.
They got Theodore. Over here! Over here! Behind the piano! I can't see! I can't feel my tail! Come on. Come on, we're gonna make it! Come on, don't give up! No! No! Gone without me! It's too late! Simon! Simon! Oh, God, look at you. They got me.
Alan!
I'm dying. My nuts.
No rest.
And they're both out.
No peace.
Great.
Gosh.
Ah, yes. 500,000 mobile phones are going to be sold in December alone. Awful lot of talking going on over Christmas about loving.
Season's greetings.
And then it sort of brings the Christmas into the summer picture, doesn't it?
Silent night, holy night, with lots...
Mm-hmm. So what are you saying? Bill, I'm going to have to wind you up here because we've got the news coming fast at one. In five words, what are you saying?
We've only been out once so far this year.
What are you saying?
Good afternoon. Driving on the M25 is still rather hazardous, even though...
Well, we seem to... Hank, can I just stop you for a second or two? Because we seem to have just a wee bit of a problem there hearing you. Are you switched on as you should be?
Yes, I'm here.
Ah, well, you sound very, very distant to me just at the moment. I don't know what we can do about that. We can have just one more go at it. We've got all the buttons pressed in the right place here. And apologies for that.
Christmas is coming.
What are you saying?
Let's get ready for the festive season together with a difference.
What a performance.
Lame. Bright sunshine one moment, we're told.
Because you read it in the Old Testament, which is the book of my people, the Jewish people. And that book wasn't good enough for you Christians. Was it? You went, no, we've got a better book with a better character. You're going to love him. And you called your book new and said our book was old. And yet every Sunday, I turn on the television set. And there's a priest or a pastor reading from my book. And interpreting it. And their interpretations, I have to tell you, are usually wrong. And it's not their fault, because it's not their book. You never see a rabbi on TV interpreting the New Testament, do you? If you want to truly understand the Old Testament, if there's something you don't quite get, there are Jews who walk among you. And they, I promise you this, will take time out of their day and interpret for you anything that you're having trouble understanding, and we will do that.
That's our situation. And of course, they have those channels that are religious that talk about Jesus. And that's one of those things that, you know, I wish they would understand that people basically, I think, know who Jesus is. Maybe I'm guessing, maybe I'm way out of line here, but I have a good feeling that generally Americans and the people throughout the world know who Jesus is. So it's a little frustrating to keep hearing about how that, you know, we need your dollars. We need your help. Because we want people to know who Jesus is. Hey! We know who Jesus is! Get a job!
Comedians Lewis Black and Sam Kinison at the end there. We heard almost the entirety of the War on Christmas Kickstarter, thanks to its creator, Scooter. You'll find more of Scooter's stuff at accessofevil.org. That's spelled A-K-S-I-S, accessofevil.org. And you'll find much more of our stuff at our own website, namely newworldnotes.blogspot.com. From Darkest Connecticut, this is Kenneth Doust, thanking you for listening to New World Notes, and advising you'll get to my non-carborundum, hoping you'll come back again next week, and wishing you the best of this Christmas season. Peace.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, 9/11 wake-up call.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. It's been 14 years since the tragic events of 9/11, and we've had two cover-up, quote, investigations, the Congressional Joint Inquiry in 2002 and the 9/11 Commission Report released in 2004. The aftermath of 9/11 brought us endless war and a demonization of Muslims. This November 2015 marks the 52nd anniversary of another tragic event in our country's history, the murder of our president, John Fitzgerald Kennedy. And it brought us another bogus, quote, investigation, the Warren Commission report. And like 9/11, the JFK assassination brought us many years of endless war and the deaths of millions in Vietnam, Laos, and Cambodia. Today, Andrew Craig joins me on the show to shed light on the JFK assassination on this 52nd anniversary. Andrew Craig is a former journalist for the Hartford Courant, and he's also an attorney. He runs a blog called the Justice Integrity Project and is the author of two books. The first one, called Spiked, came out in the 1980s, and his more recent book is called Presidential Puppetry. He's also done a lot of research and writing on the Kennedy assassination, and in September of 2014, participated in the 50th anniversary conference of the Warren Commission report. Andrew Craig has been on the show a few times before to share his wisdom, and it's a pleasure to have him back again today. Andrew Craig, welcome to the show.
Oh, it's so good to be back, Cheryl. Thank you.
So I understand that there's a conference in Dallas, the anniversary of the JFK assassination in Dallas this year. Maybe you could tell us a little bit about that?
Well, a group called the JFK Historical Group is putting on what is a third rendition of an annual conference on the assassination and new developments. It's at the Dallas Crown Hotel from November 20th to 22nd, and I'm giving a talk on the 21st, Saturday, and the topic is essentially why people should care still about the JFK assassination, particularly young people.
Maybe you could tell us a little bit about that. Why should people still care about that? It's been over 50 years ago. What is it, 52 now?
My basic theme in this is that by understanding this particular and unique historical situation, we can much better understand what's going on right now, which is very hard to do because we have all kinds of government secrets, confusing comments from government officials and the media. And it's extremely hard to figure out what's going on, whether it's in Congress, the White House, or foreign affairs. But in this much-studied historical situation, we have millions of pages of declassified documents, and we can compare fairly accurately what people were saying, what important institutions were saying against a kind of objective record. And some of these players and most of the institutions are still with us. So we know what they were capable of 53 years ago, 52, I guess it is. And that provides us an opportunity to assess what they're telling us now. So it's a unique opportunity. It's not just for historical buffs. And in fact, the reason I personally got into it as an investigative reporter is not a fascination necessarily with that historical event, but to try to work through in my current investigative reporting some of the very alarming possibilities that I was sensing, but there's just not so conveniently the full record of thousands of books and all these millions of pages of declassified materials.
So you see some of the same actors from then and now. Can you name a few of those?
Well, yeah, mostly institutions, although maybe to more directly answer your question, some of the actors are pretending to be journalists. So, for example, it's little remembered, except by researchers, that Dan Rather, Bob Schieffer, Bill Moyers, Jim Lehrer all got their start, really, in a big way, by covering the JFK assassination. And many, many others who were there and playing important roles went on to long careers, and most of them are close to retirement. But there's still, those that are alive are still held up as the great truth tellers and the great examples of American journalism. And my research has indicated that all of them that I named there and many, many others and their employers have a lot to be answered for, if not ashamed of, in their reports through the years or their lack of reports through the years about the very historical situation where they got their fame, they got their careers in many ways. And I will add as a footnote that Bill Moyers, who's just an incredibly eloquent man, a great force for progressive causes in his later years, was the press secretary for Lyndon Johnson. And as such, he was one of the most important people in America at that time. And if you believe, as I do, that there was a cover-up, he was the one person in charge of it. And we have declassified records indicating that. But when we look at him over his career, this is not really discussed. And yet that's a very important 50-year career. He formally retired earlier this year. But almost no one, except in a conversation like this on your show, has the ability to challenge people at that kind of Bill Moyers, Bob Schieffer, Dan Rather level.
So, like, Bill Moyers is, like, this really likable guy. You know, he looks like somebody you could really trust. And in more recent years, as you said, he looks like he's a leader of progressive causes. What do you think? Has he changed, or is this more of the same, making us believe he's somebody he's not?
Well, I think it's very complicated. He was an ordained minister before he went to work for Lyndon Johnson. So Johnson must have seen within this young man great talent, but also a person whose career, words, and what must have been a commitment to spiritual matters would be useful to him. And in fact, we know that from the biographies of Johnson, like those of Robert Caro and elsewhere. And from the Moyers standpoint, we mostly have to speculate because among his vast outpourings of journalism, including great journalism, he's very rarely, if ever, talked about his role in the Kennedy assassination. And we have to assume that for someone so eloquent and thoughtful as he, that this kind of gap is not an accident. It must be a quite painful area of conflict. So we have to now move into the realm of informed, hopefully, supposition. And Johnson was one of the great charmers of American political life, with men and women, aides, voters, and so forth. But he was also capable of really vile and horrible actions, and noble actions as well, like the Civil Rights Act. But the cover-up of the murder of the president who preceded him is almost a certainty. And there could be much worse that Johnson and Moyers have to hide there. And if, as is likely in my view, Moyers was charmed by both the man and the opportunity for a young man to get ahead in Washington, this is a hard topic to raise. And in fact, one little-known thing, Cheryl, that struck me when Moyers retired earlier this year is that he was in charge of a foundation, the Bill Moyers Foundation, that had assets, as I recall, of $27 or $28 million and was very generous to progressive news organizations such as Democracy Now! Show, I believe that's on PBS, and Mother Jones and The Nation magazine. And one of my friends, fellow JFK researcher Jerry Polyakov, who's been researching these matters since the 1960s, he looked at the list that I published, getting it from the Washington Post retirement story on Bill Moyers, and he said, this is exactly the list of progressive publications that will not dig into the Kennedy assassination. And I said, really?
Nor 9/11.
Yeah, and Jerry said, I've been trying to figure out why they won't do it, but when I see that in 1 year, Democracy Now! Got $700,000 from the Bill Moyers Foundation.
Yeah.
And so all of this, Cheryl, is going back to your question, why should we care now? Well, if you're getting news from CBS, which employed Dan Rather and Bob Schieffer in total for, you know, 50 years or so, if you're getting your news from PBS or these other outlets, it's important to know that all of them have maintained silence about relevant facts of this assassination for 52 years. And so the question is, what else are they keeping quiet?
Right. And we know one of them is definitely 9/11, and who knows what else, right?
Yes.
I actually went on several, like, Free Speech TV and Link TV and Democracy Now! And looked at some of the other foundations they're getting money from, and they're all getting money from almost the same sources, and they all won't touch Kennedy assassination or 9/11. So it's quite interesting.
Some of these people I've gotten to know in my work here in Washington. I've now been here about 25 years and in a variety of ways been a nonprofit executive and very interested in both civic issues, but other things, just business development and so forth. But I've met Dan Rather, Bob Schieffer, and a number of others. And as I embarked about 7 years ago in my current incarnation, reporting underreported stories at the Justice Integrity Project that I had hoped to go back to these people that I just mentioned and try to get on their programs now or get some blurb or something, because I've always admired their eloquence, their ability to tell a story. And actually, with Bill Moyers, he does so many different things. That one time at the National Press Club about 3 or 4 years ago, I went to hear a lecture that he gave, drug addiction of his son, heroin addiction. And I had hoped to talk with him afterwards about some of the things I'm doing. But I was just so impressed at the pain that he and his family had gone through. He was there with his son and wife, and describing how at one point they didn't even know where their adult son was, and he turned out to be in a drug den in New York City. And I wanted to mention this to your listeners to say that the headline of my answer to you is kind of blunt, but when we have a chance, like on the show with your generous amount of time, it becomes more complex and a lot more convoluted story. And so I never went up to Moyers, and I've never gone to Dan Rather and Bob Schieffer really again, because I realize that if I'm going to tell my stories, at least part of it is going to be about JFK, and what's the point of either hiding that from them or trying to get their endorsement? It's just better to, even in a celebrity-driven media environment and culture, it's better just to try to tell the story, have some compassion and empathy for what they've achieved otherwise, but still point out that this is very shameful for what they did on the JFK assassination.
Right. I know, like, Bill Moyers has been very good on pointing out the organization ALEC and what they're doing at state legislative levels to drive the legislation for big business interests, et cetera. So I appreciate what he's done on that. But I agree with you that it altered our nation, and not for the better, after the Kennedy assassination, followed up by many other assassinations and then false flags like 9/11. So it does have grave consequences. So you're going to be at this event in Dallas. And tell me, is there anything new that's come out in the research? I know in 1992, I guess a lot of documents were released that had been classified. Is there any new information out there that you've been researching?
Yes, there's tons of information, and I track it pretty closely. And in fact, I'm on five or six different Facebook groups of different researchers on JFK alone. And I'm also on an email list of scholars, most of whom have gone back at least 35 or 40 years in researching things, and they share what they're working on, what new points are coming out. So there's tons of stuff, and a lot of it will be revealed at this conference I'm speaking at, which is at the Dallas Crown Plaza. But I should mention that there's another conference that's important also right up the street at the Adolphus Hotel that covers the same days, and I'm registered to attend that one as well as speak at the other. And so I'm going to be shuttling back and forth between these two conferences, where a lot of scholars and other researchers have saved up new information that's just coming out recently. But you mentioned 1992. There's been so much since 1992, Cheryl. I think too much of the world that follows this community, one of the biggest things is a new biography written by my friend David Talbot, the founder of Salon Magazine, on Alan Dulles. It's called The Devil's Chessboard, and it's the life of Alan Dulles, head of the CIA from 1953 to 1961, when President Kennedy forced him out along with his two top aides. Kennedy was furious at them, and Dulles ended up as one of the seven members of the Warren Commission investigating the death that many of us think the CIA and his former colleagues there helped orchestrate. By the way, one of the other people forced out, General Charles Cable, we don't need Dr. Sigmund Freud to know that one. That mistake. But anyway, General Cable, his brother, Earl Cable, was mayor of a place called Dallas.
Oh, no.
And so when people think, well, how could these things all be created? You know, how could a cover-up and so forth exist? Well, let's just say we know from declassified documents on other things, as well as this, that this is exactly what people at the CIA did, is orchestrate plots. I mean, this is where spy movies come out of. And if you have a perfect death trap at Dealey Plaza, you know, kind of a bowl-shaped park where anything can happen, and that's where President Kennedy was killed. And by the way, it's just a couple blocks from the site of these two conferences later this month. All the pieces were in place. And so this new book, it's about 700 pages, The Devil's Chessboard, recounts the career of Alan Dulles going back to his days as a Wall Street lawyer with his brother, John Foster Dulles, future Secretary of State, where they represented some of the wealthiest families in world history as Wall Street lawyers, and then shuttled back and forth into the intelligence and foreign affairs community. And so that's an important book. Here's another development that I'm just writing a column for the Justice Integrity Project site. And I'm looking at this book, The Devil's Chessboard, and several other developments to point out recent illustrations of how much covert influence the CIA and other intelligence agencies have over our cultural and political and academic life and journalism. Now, here's what one of the reasons I'm talking about this. Just last week, a fellow JFK researcher, Jefferson Morley, who used to work at the Washington Post for many years as a reporter, he noticed that in the obituary of a man named Charles Briggs last week, the obituary in the Washington Post said that he helped found the sixth-floor museum in Dallas, which is located on the sixth floor of the building where Oswald supposedly shot President Kennedy. And this sixth-floor museum is like the major museum in Texas and arguably one of the major museums in the whole country, devoted to this historical record of the assassination. And Jeff Morley makes the apt note, why would the number three person at the CIA help found a museum about the JFK assassination?
Yeah, very interesting.
And the reason, of course, although we have to put on our powers of supposition here, this just happened, but if the CIA and Alan Dulles and many others had this role in helping, at the minimum, cover up the real story of the assassination and perhaps planning it using Cuban exiles and mafia triggermen, well, of course they'd want to help run the museum. And I know that museum, and the longtime executive director also just died this year, and he had been considered a reasonably honest and straightforward researcher. And then he gets his job as head of the museum, and it's kind of a dream job for a researcher because he actually had paid for this stuff. But people said, well, he continued to be friendly, but suddenly the whole theme from him is always, well, Oswald did it. Maybe there's a few loose ends. But this museum is very pro-Warren Commission, anti-alternative evidence. Authors of books critical of the Warren Commission have a hard time getting their stuff in there. And it's all part of a pattern that I research elsewhere in American life, that what we think are independent cultural institutions are really have some hidden agenda or funding source. And there's lots of others. As you know, my book, Presidential Puppetry, points out that a lot of our political candidates, including President Obama and actually all other presidents after Jimmy Carter, have been assets of either the CIA or FBI before they entered politics. And we can look and see all kinds of influences in the media, in academia. And another such new development I'm going to write about tomorrow. So we've just talked about this museum. It turns out there's a new book by a professor at Providence College in Rhode Island. And he has found out through sleuthing, even though he's an English professor, that the very, very influential and famous Iowa Writers' Workshop, was funded by the CIA, and that he was an attendee at this. It was one of the highlights of his career as a young academic. I think he still is. But he bravely researched this. And in it, he says that at this writer's workshop, they discouraged novels that addressed pressing social concerns, and that that was a kind of rejected category. And the eminent, you know, I'm sure they're all wearing tweed jackets with horn-rimmed glasses and elbow patches and the whole thing. They'd look down their nose at people who wanted to convey through their novels important issues. And they'd say, well, why don't you just write an op-ed? And it's not literature. And what he, I think, is doing in his book, and he mentions some other famous writing workshops that similarly had this kind of funding, and also the Partisan Review or the Parisian Review that George Plimpton used to be in. But that was CIA-funded, too, it turns out. By the way, here's one new thing that I guess has been around, but I've just been writing about it in my 28-segment JFK Reader's Guide that's on the Justice Integrity Project site. I've recently documented and learned that the head of Life and Time magazine at the time of the JFK assassination was considered, Cheryl, get this, the number one expert in the United States on psychological warfare.
Wow.
So his name was Charles, initial C.D. Jackson, and he had started at Time Life with Henry Luce, Yale man, by the way, in 1931, Charles Jackson did. And he went back and forth between spy agencies and Time Life Fortune. And he had service as assistant to President Eisenhower for, I think it was for psychological warfare or some title like that. But he was right there in the White House as assistant to the president. And then he goes to Time Life. And here's the implications, just to connect the dots.
Yeah.
And particularly for those who are younger in your audience, they probably don't recall that these were the two most important magazines in the entire United States. They were owned by the same company. But Life was this picture magazine that conveyed to us some of the most important images. It had competitors, the Look magazine and Saturday Evening Post, but none of them really had the stature of Life magazine.
Right.
And then Time magazine was much more important than what we see now on the newsstands. It was really the Bible of current affairs for busy people, particularly before TV news really took hold. Of course, there was no cable news, and newspapers weren't very good in a lot of ways. And so the responsible citizen would get Time magazine, or maybe Newsweek, or U.S. News and World Report, but the responsible citizen would get at least one of those throughout the country. And so to have both of those magazines under control of a psychological warfare expert.
Yeah, it's pretty frightening, actually.
And it doesn't end just there, because Jackson acquired the Zapruder film exclusively for Time Life magazine. And they suppressed it for a dozen years until a pirated copy seeped out a dozen years later. But only the editors of Time Life really had access to this movie of the assassination. And they used selective images to promote the Warren Commission story. And everybody else had to use these images and timeline and so forth. And the other thing is, he locked up the memoirs of Oswald's widow, Marina Oswald, exclusively. So here she is. She's the one who knows the guy. And they've got the memoirs exclusively. And you know what? They never published them.
Are they still locked up somewhere?
Yeah.
Wow.
Well, it's a slightly more complicated story. Mm-hmm. But the point is, if you think it's like a marketplace of ideas and that they want to make a buck by getting these two very important things for their publication, and then they sell the magazine and everybody gets to know, Well, that can't be the whole story here. Right. Otherwise, they would have published her memoirs. It's a story worth vastly more dead than alive. And just like the Zapruder film, they didn't want people seeing that film. They wanted people to see parts of it.
And why didn't they want people to see it? What's revealed in that that they didn't want people to see?
Well, part of it is Dan Rather's hypocrisy, because he was the only reporter allowed to see it. And he did a report on it 3 days after the assassination as a young CBS reporter. And in the report, and I'm paraphrasing now, but your listeners can look it up on YouTube and see it, he says, and you could see the president's head going violently forward with the fatal shot. Now, Oswald was supposedly at the rear. Well, actually, he was at the rear. And so the Warren Commission's report says only Oswald fired and only from the rear, and he had no collaborators or co-conspirators. And so if the Zapruder film shows the president's head moving forward, the kind of common sense view is, well, he must have been shot from the back, and that's where Oswald was. So the Warren Commission's right. But the point is that once you look at the Zapruder film, the head is actually going back.
Right.
And most witnesses thought shooting was coming from the right front, the so-called grassy knoll area. And if you look at photos, you see a bunch of people running up the hill, the grassy knoll, trying to find who the shooters were behind the picket fence there. And there's other evidence that I've done a lot of work on, I'm still doing work on, that if you take a look at Oswald, he may not have been at this sixth floor at all. He was in the lunchroom on the second floor 90 seconds after the thing happened. And if you look at almost every part of the evidence against Oswald, you just look at it with kind of an open mind, there's at least a question about almost all of it.
You've just been listening to the first part of an interview with author and journalist and attorney Andrew Craig. Tune in next week to hear the conclusion of this interview. Andrew Craig's website is justice-integrityproject.org, so justice-integrityproject.org, where you can find great articles and an in-depth guide to the Kennedy assassination. This concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.
Power to the people! Power to the people!
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, building bridges.
Building Bridges with Ken Nash and Mimi Rosenberg.
Later on, Joint Terrorism Task Force and Lockheed Martin to surveil workers calling for $15 an hour and full-time work.
But first, Holly Okuno is a founder and co-director of Cooperative Jackson, an emerging network of worker cooperatives and supporting institutions in Jackson, Mississippi. Holly also served as the co-director of the U.S. Human Rights Network, the executive director of the People's Hurricane Relief Fund, based in New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina, and some of his most noted works, all of which I have read carefully, as should you. Recently, Casting Shadows, Chokwe Lumumba, and the Struggle for Racial Justice and Economic Democracy in Jackson, Mississippi, Revolutionary Nationalism for the 21st Century, and Until We Win Black Labor and Liberation in the Disposable Era. Holly Okuno joins us from
Paris and the Climate Summit.
Thank you. Thank you. Good to be here.
Well, first of all, you're there with a coalition of groups. And what made it imperative for you from Jackson, Mississippi, to head to the Paris climate talks? What's the correlation between what's happening there and issues on the ground for democracy and development here for the working class?
Just to give the audience some contextualization, I was planning on being here as far back as 2013 and was looking forward to being here to represent the administration of Chokwe Lumumba and our efforts at making Jackson the most sustainable city in the Southeast, if not the United States and the world. We had designed a fairly comprehensive program on how to make our city a zero emissions and a zero waste city by 2025. That was part of the Jackson Rising vision that was key to our administration's program, but also to the campaign program that got Chokwe elected. So me being here and Cooperation Jackson being here really has been in the making for some time. We've been traveling with like-minded comrades through the Grassroots Global Justice Alliance, through the Climate Justice Alliance, in the Intex Roots delegation of which we are part of, where we call the Freedom Road from Jackson to Paris contingent of the It Takes Roots to Weather the Storm delegation. But we've been members of the Grassroots Global Justice Alliance for almost 10 years, and we recently became an Our Power pilot site in 2014, this being Cooperation Jackson. So we're here really fulfilling a long-term strategic aim and objective. I mean, we just want people in the audience to really understand that.
Maybe you can also just give us a sense of some of the ambiance that is occurring generally in relationship to the climate talks amongst the populations of people that are in Paris now.
It's very different than what I think we were hoping for, just to be honest. Since the events of November 13th, that tragedy, the conversation has shifted profoundly. There's much more of a conversation around security and climate change than we would have hoped and liked, because it shifts the dynamics, it shifts the focus, it shifts the onus of energy and attention, and quite frankly, the resources. We are experiencing a very heavy police and military presence at all of the events, at all of the kind of historic sites of Paris. So you get a different feel of the city, of the negotiations. And I think we were anticipating it being a much more open, democratic, and expressive space, as we were planning on being here for well over, like I said, in some cases, almost 3 years. So it shifted some things. And what you're finding and what we're finding, the voice of the social movements have been muted, basically, to this point. And we're searching for all the cracks and crevices we can to make our voice heard, to get our message across against the kind of repression and the stifling of dissent that the state has basically ordered. We're experimenting. Groups are trying to figure out a number of different things. There have been small protests every single day, and we're just trying to figure out ways to get them amplified, one of which is, you know, talking to yourselves and to the audience back at home to let them know that folks are still trying to resist and still trying to figure it out and still challenging, you know, the quote-unquote official negotiations that are taking place and the false solutions that are coming out of the COP 21.
Kali, what is an agenda for power for working and poor people and communities of color at these talks, whether it's, of course, coalescing amongst other people similar to yourselves, or whether or not it's influencing or both the talks that are going on amongst the 190 representatives from government?
Well, there's a number of different strategies that organizations within the It Takes Roots delegation are exploring. Some folks are inside trying to battle there, and they're going over all the wording of the official document and fighting for things that would assert our values, our vision, give us some protection, alter some things. There's a number of people who are doing that. But the vast majority of us are really working within the civil society space and in the broad social movement space. And there, we're trying to educate the broader public about what's going on, about how bad the deal that's being constructed is, how it's going to have an impact on their lives and on the lives of their children and grandchildren, and that we have to stop it and what we can do to stop it. That's the primary thing that we've been really focusing on. In the present context, you know, we're doing a lot of art, creating public art to get people kind of shooken up a little bit, or just made aware that things are going on, what's being decided. There are innovative demonstration, flash mobs and things of that nature that are kind of taking place, and still have some attempts at doing some demonstrations. So all those different things are going on. But we're really starting to shift gears to a certain extent on thinking about what is really going to happen and needs to happen, because we know what's coming out of here at this point is going to be terrible. It's going to burn the planet, literally. And we have to figure out how to put the onus of the change back in the hands of the people and develop a strategy and a program that's going to actually build real concrete alternatives, like we're trying to do in Jackson, Mississippi. But at the same time, we have to challenge the powers of the state. We have to challenge the power of the corporations and capital to make them be not only accountable, which is the first step, but to move towards systems change. It comes in the forms of reparations, technology transfers, changing how they do business, not just in terms of clean, but reappropriating a lot of those resources and funds so they're distributed equally to those that need them, communities on the front lines and the different peoples and countries in Africa, Asia, Oceania, and Latin America. So these are some of the things that we're really trying to build a broad international social movement here on out to really advance the fight back action if needed.
And further, just elaborate, and we should say, just in case there are some people earlier who didn't know, that Chokwe Lumumba was elected a mayor of Jackson, Mississippi, and regrettably died prematurely and did enormous things and had enormous vision down in the South with his regime, which people like Kali continue. Tell us what you think a climate justice agenda would be in the aftermath of the talks that you bring back to this country. And of course, one of the things that I am still very critical of the quote unquote progressive movement here is that issues of environmental racism and so on have not really been brought to the fore as part of our agenda. But what do you see as strategic when you return to this country for us to continue to work on?
Well, you started with number one on our agenda, which is tackling environmental racism. I mean, that's number one. If that's not really dealt with, what's going to wind up happening is them shifting more and more of the problem onto Black, Latino, and other oppressed communities. That's just a political reality. If we don't face it, that's what's going to happen in both the short and the midterm. So we got to confront that and make it a top priority. I would say number two on the agenda is we have to really focus and fight on the oil companies and the other kind of power companies. We have to shift to zero emissions immediately within the United States. We have to make a hard case and a serious fight to do that. So imagine the tar sands times 100, that fight. That's what we basically need. So they need to keep it in the ground. And we all need to invest in the alternative, solar, thermal, and other forms of energy, which are within our grasp, which can be made affordable if the investment and the political will was there. The resources exist, the political will does not. So we have to really focus in on that. Then I think some of the more practical things that we can do on about a local level is really fight for a just transition program. The one that we've been innovating in Jackson really focuses on getting our city to become a zero emission city in 10 years and a zero waste city in 10 years. And to do this in such a manner which creates jobs for our people in the community, not only in just things like solar thermal installation and repair, but you got weatherization, you got new methods of construction to rebuild the infrastructure that's needed. You can take all the different waste products and create industries off of that, from composting to new forms of manufacturing with the recycled materials. So we're looking at it not only as just fighting climate change, but we're also fighting the impoverishment of our people at the same time. That's Cooperation Jackson's core mission, and that's part of the core mission of the Climate Justice Alliance and Our Power campaign. So those are the three things that I would really highlight to our audience and to our audience in the United States that we need to focus on.
Kali, would you also say that looking at the fossil fuel economy as a driver of multifaceted crises around the world is a significant issue for the Grassroots Global Justice Alliance and the various progressive organizations that have come to these climate talks?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, one of the key slogans, particularly of TGA and the Grassroots Global Justice Alliance, is no war, no warming. And we understand that a large part of the imperial conquest of the last 10 years, if not longer, but definitely the last, since the Bush administration It's only been about water resources and, more importantly, oil resources in North Africa. And we see that program continuing now. And then you have the boom of the fracking industry in the United States, which really expanded to really undermine some progressive governments, particularly Venezuela and some others. So there's a direct link to the promotion of war and to the destruction of our own communities and things in our backyard that are really fostered and driven by the petrochemical industry, which is why we got to tackle it and basically get it to cease as an industry, which is why we're focusing on that second piece that I mentioned, which is keeping it on the ground. So these are core things that this entire alliance has agreed upon and is trying to focus on developing effective and winning strategies on a local, on a national, and even an international basis.
So the alliance links together. That's meaningful. That's progressive. This has to be an international movement. What is, for you, the takeaway, particularly in terms of some of the cynicism that you've expressed about what the global powers are going to recognize from these climate talks? What is the takeaway for us?
If I can, I don't see it necessarily as cynicism. I see it as telling the truth to our people and to not promote false hope and false solutions. And the sooner we can come to grips with the truth of what's happening is that, you know, these corporations and the nation states are in complete collusion and agreement on burning the planet. They're putting profits over people. That is their agenda. And as soon as we come to grips with that and develop a program and a strategy to fight back and to create the alternative, I think the better we will be, because we have to save ourselves. They're not going to do it. I mean, that's not why I came here. I don't believe that's why most of the forces that are part of our alliance are coming to try to convince people that this negotiation is going to save us. After 20 years of ongoing talks and failure after failure, I think we have to kind of recognize that they have just kind of created a negotiations industry, and mainly it's Western Europe and the United States that are just kind of dragging this process along so they can continue doing what they're doing. So we need to clearly educate people and to demonstrate through action they don't intend on changing unless we force them to change, and we have to build the strength to force that change. And in the meantime, we also have to build the concrete alternatives on the ground in our communities so that when the change inevitably comes, we are in a position to dictate how that's going to look, who it's going to serve, and not have the corporations do that for.
Kali Okuno, we're going to insist that you rejoin us when you're back in the States, and we want to pick up on more of what's happening down in Jackson, Mississippi, and the work that you're doing as founder and co-director of Cooperation Jackson. You have some of the most creative, incisive ideas. The reality of what we just skimmed the surface of, talking about environmental racism, is of strategic importance to build in to our movement for climate justice. And thank you so much for this brief understanding of the work that you're doing down there, and we'll continue and we'll pick up on it when you return to the States.
Looking forward to it.
And we've been speaking with Kali Okuno.
Madagascar, Congo River Basin, California, Norway and Brazil, land across our planet, both tropical and temperate, with sacred rainforests that clean up all the air. Far away over here, trees clean up our atmosphere. We breathe in, they breathe out, something we can't live without. Southeast Asia, Chile and New Zealand, Tanzania, Niger and Gabon,
Hayes Greenfield, music for a green planet. Have thought, really, who would have thought that Walmart was engaging in FBI Joint Terrorism Task Force and Lockheed Martin contracted with to surveil workers who are merely calling for a $15 an hour wage and full-time work? Well, we're going to find out a lot more about that now with Dan Schlegelman, co-director of Our Walmart. And let's just begin. Wait a minute. Lockheed Martin surveilling workers fighting for decent conditions. First of all, thank you for being with us. And do tell us what in the world is going on and how it was uncovered. Who wants to begin?
So the background is this. So in 2013, Walmart workers around the country went on prolonged unfair labor practice strikes where they got on buses and rode across the country and ended up at Walmart's annual shareholder meeting with an event that was called a Ride for Respect. After those workers completed the Ride for Respect and went back to work, Walmart began to illegally terminate and discipline workers who engaged in that. And that case went in front of the National Labor Relations Board, the federal government, and the government ruled that Walmart had violated those workers' rights. And so as a part of that, there's been a hearing going on where Walmart was required to give over documents related to that. It was in those documents where we found that Walmart talked about how they were partnering with the FBI Terrorism Task Force and about how they had an ongoing contract with Lockheed Martin.
Just to expand on that just for a second before we really get into it, the Lockheed Martin was doing the surveillance. What was the FBI doing?
At this point, it's still unclear. We're going to be gathering and requesting documents to find out exactly what they were doing. But the way the documents referenced it was they were looking at them and partnering with the FBI around the work we were doing around Walmart's annual shareholder meeting, where striking workers were talking about the issues that they were facing and about how they were being retaliated against for speaking up about raising wages and conditions at Walmart.
Tell us more about how this came to light.
This came to light because Our Walmart, the organization that Walmart workers are building, is challenging Walmart like never before. And, you know, things that Walmart, you know, normally would just get away with and wouldn't be exposed, Our Walmart has been able to shine light on it and show that, you know, this is the kind of way that Walmart treats and thinks about its own employees. You know, the part that struck me a lot about the Lockheed Martin piece was that the person who they were coordinating with, Lockheed Martin, you know, he had a tagline under his name, and it was a Latin saying, and, you know, a lot of us will have different, you know, different taglines under our name, Gandhi quotes or Martin Luther King quotes. His was a Latin phrase that said, if you want peace, prepare for war. And so the fact that Walmart would be asking people who, you know, have that kind of a philosophy to be tracking their employees just really speaks volumes as to the way that Walmart really thinks about their own workforce, who, you know, our long-term employees who are just trying to make the company a better place, who are trying to put food on their table, who are trying to take care of their kids, who are trying to, you know, make sure that they've got a chance for a better future. And so it really is an incredible development.
And the consequences of the tracking by Walmart, Lockheed, and possibly the FBI of these employees who are just protesting for better pay and working conditions in many cases was they were fired and disciplined. Is that correct?
Yeah, for the workers who were on the Ride for Respect, over 70 of them were either fired or disciplined illegally. And that's the case that currently the government is hearing against Walmart. And we're hoping to get a decision on that case sometime in early 2016.
Do you find it surprising that a multi-billion-dollar corporation actually feels the need, aside from the outrage of the spying itself, that it would actually feel the need to spy on its own employees just to stop them from really earning essentially a better life?
I mean, I wish I could say that it was surprising. I mean, I think for the amount of times that workers have said to me or you know, said to organizers or said to leaders of Our Walmart, you know, sort of their, you know, that Walmart is watching them, you know, this is certainly, you know, a reminder of that. But again, I just think it's also a reminder how afraid Walmart is of Our Walmart. I mean, this organization, you know, is being built by Walmart workers across the country. It's, you know, challenging the company like it's never been before. The company has, you know, given 500,000 workers a raise as a result of the work of the organization, has put billions of dollars into the hands of its lowest paid employees. And so, you know, the organization is having a huge impact on the company. And so I think the company is, you know, rather than doing the right thing as a resource and as the people who are helping this company make the hundreds of billions of dollars that they make every year, it's treating them like an enemy. Our Walmart is both going to continue on, and it's never going to go away. And it's, you know, Walmart's better off taking the resources that they're wasting, really putting it into work of making the company a better place for its workers.
Has there been any response from anybody in the federal government, either legislative or executive, as to the role of the FBI in this?
Well, we are going to be launching a petition in a big way to a number of the committees that oversee the FBI. And those members, we're going to be asking them to weigh in on this. We've had conversations with a number of elected officials who have been aghast by this and have committed to help us understand more and, you know, help us to end this practice is happening. So all of that is underway. I mean, getting the story out there was step one, and, you know, we're now going to be running a full campaign to shine a bigger light on this.
Dan, what did they actually do? What methodology? Was this phone tapping? Was this opening mail? Was this trailing people? All of the above? I mean, I'm really interested. I mean, Lockheed Martin, one of the lucrative corporations in the world, in conjunction with the FBI Joint Terrorism Task Force. What a terrifying abuse of a public trust, among other things. But how did they actually surveil these people? Do you have any direct information on that?
I mean, we really just have these glimpses of information. I mean, again, you know, under the discovery of the hearing, Walmart was required to turn over huge amounts of documents. And our sense is, I mean, we just don't know, but if we were to speculate, our speculation is that these documents kind of slipped through the cracks, you know, that made the references to the FBI Joint Terrorism Task Force, and then as well as relationship to Lockheed Martin. We didn't get a lot of other documents. Under the testimony that Karen Casey gave in front of the federal government on this, you know, she acted as if it was, you know, a matter of fact. It wasn't, you know, wasn't anything out of the ordinary for the way the company operates. You know, sort of just treated as if it was just the way they operate. And
she's
so,
the labor relations director there at Walmart.
She was the head. Yeah, that's right. She was the head of labor relations. She's now moved on to sort of a different part of the company, but at that point she was the head of their labor relations.
You know, what fascinates me in all of this is Les Lockheed Martin, who one might guess had a private contract, or one wonders, were they enlisted by the FBI Joint Terrorism Task Force? But the kind of collusion and using that may be there, but using a body like the FBI Joint Terrorism Task Force for a private corporation to surveil its workers is just absolutely unconscionable and staggering and frightening that the government would undertake such a task. So what does this mean about, so those of us who use the term plutocracy, does it mean that Walmart runs the government? Well, to some degrees, with Citizens United and other things, we understand the monies that are poured into electoral politics by these corporations. But how do you politically begin to look at, and what is our Walmart going to do on one level about just the public component of that, the FBI Joint Terrorism Task Force? Is there litigation planned? Is there an appeal, aside from the petition, to the Department of Justice and the Obama administration?
Yeah, I mean, I think we're looking at all those questions. I think, we want to get a better understanding of what was happening, what still may be happening or may not be happening. Happen any further, because, you know, our Walmart is not engaging in any kind of conduct that would require any kind of FBI engagement. And so our goal really is to shine as bright of a light on this as possible and work to end the practice. Workers should have a right to use their First Amendment rights without having to worry that they have the FBI or other military industrial giants watching them. People have a right to speak out for change. It's the most basic value of our country. And the fact that a company like Walmart, who, you know, is incredibly powerful. I mean, there are only two things larger on earth than Walmart. One is the U.S. Department of Defense, and the other is the Chinese Liberation Army. I mean, Walmart is a huge player in our economy and a huge player across our globe. And so there's no question that they have power, but our elected officials are supposed to keep a check and balance of, you know, that power. And, you know, our goal will be to make sure that, those checks and balances get back in place.
And just quickly, because we're running out of time, is there a good chance as a result of this that those workers that were fired or disciplined would get their jobs back if the National Labor Relations Board finds this to be an unfair labor practice?
Absolutely. I mean, our hope is that, our belief is that everything that workers were doing was protected and that what Walmart did was illegal. And so when the judge rules in that way, the remedy would be that workers would be returned back to work and would get back pay for any lost wages as a result of it.
What a wonderful understatement, though. You know, really, when you're talking about the National Labor Relations Board, and it's like unfair labor practice. People are being surveilled by the Joint Terrorism Task Force and Lockheed Martin. My goodness, we have gotten, I wonder when they bring back the Pinkertons. Just in the seconds left, where does our Walmart go from here? Because they will not be daunted, and we have to be very vigilant about all this and support our Walmart even more to make sure that our legislators know about this absolute atrocity that is being committed.
Yeah, I mean, we're going to go forward and continue on the work to change Walmart. There's a lot more to be done, and we just had great work on this past Black Friday with lots and lots of supporters and workers, and you know, we'll be continuing on into 2016 and looking forward to using the national election to really highlight the issues of Walmart and as well as these issues we're talking about. So the work of our Walmart will continue on, and we're excited for the future.
I'm going to start trailing Alice Walton. Well, anyway, Dan Schladelman, co-director of our Walmart, we want to thank you. This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
This Way Out.
ISIS has systematically murdered people by pushing them off the rooftops of buildings, by stoning people to death, by shooting people. And more recently, we've been hearing stories from colleagues in Iraq and Syria that some ISIS agents have actually been tying weights around the neck of people they intend to execute for alleged homosexual acts so that they're sure that when they push them off the building, it will be their head that hits the ground first. Okay.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. Ireland bans bias against queer school teachers, Austrian kids sue for their parents' marriage rights, and Syrian refugees are not all created equal. Those stories and more this week, now that you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Tanya Kane Perry.
And I'm Wenzel Jones.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBT communities around the world for the 2 weeks ending December 5th, 2015. Members of the lower house of Ireland's parliament voted on December 2nd to effectively ban schools in the country, most of which are owned and operated by the Roman Catholic Church, from discriminating against LGBT teachers and other employees. The Senate had already approved the amendment to the Employment Equality Act. It removes exemptions that had allowed schools and hospitals to take action to prevent employees from undermining the religious ethos of the institution. Sandra Irwin-Gowron of the Gay and Lesbian Equality Network said the change removes what she called the chill factor and will now allow LGBT people to be themselves, get married, and have a family without a threat to their job if they work in a religious-run institution. Passage of the amendment this week caps off a wonderful year for LGBT rights in the Republic of Ireland. In May, Irish citizens made theirs the first country in the world to open civil marriage to gay and lesbian couples through a voter referendum.
Meanwhile, lawyers for two same-gender couples in Northern Ireland, who are stuck in less-than-equal civil partnerships, argued in a landmark legal case at the High Court in Belfast this week that the government's refusal to endorse a marriage equality bill constitutes state discrimination. They said the intransigence is having a corrosive impact on society. Government lawyers basically argued that civil partnerships meet basic international human rights requirements. The judge says he expects to issue his ruling after Christmas. Civil marriage is already open to same-gender couples in England, Wales, Scotland, and the Republic of Ireland.
Despite strong opposition from the country's Orthodox Church, lawmakers on the Mediterranean island of Cyprus voted 39-12 on November 26th to create civil unions for lesbian and gay couples. Joint adoption rights, however, were pointedly not part of the bill. Nevertheless, the European region of ILGA, the International Lesbian, Gay, Bisexual, Trans, and Intersex Association, applauded the first-ever legal recognition of same-gender couples in the country. Cyprus has been under pressure to improve its LGBT rights legislation since it joined the European Union in 2004. The capital city of Nicosia hosted its first-ever LGBT Pride March just last year.
Meanwhile, lawmakers in the Australian state of Queensland voted 64-22 this week to restore civil unions for both same-gender and heterosexual couples. They were created by a Labor government in 2008 and had even allowed an official marriage-like ceremony. But they were downgraded to registered relationships in 2012 by the Liberal Nationals, who also removed same-gender couples' ability to have children through surrogacy. LGBT rights advocates lauded the restoration, but continue their push for full marriage equality.
The Supreme Court of Bermuda ruled on November 27th that foreign same-gender spouses legally married to the Caribbean islands' gay and lesbian citizens are entitled to the same residency and employment rights as their heterosexual counterparts. Chief Justice Ian Kowali supported a group of bi-national plaintiff couples in the lawsuit against government officials. He said of current law in his ruling that the direct discrimination was self-evident and quite obvious, and no coherent counterargument was advanced by lawyers for the Minister of Home Affairs and the Attorney General. Kowali gave the government 2 weeks to appeal his ruling.
And as the Monty Python gang might say, now for something completely different. Five children with lesbian and gay parents are suing for their moms and dads' civil marriage equality in Austria. The country grants equal parenting rights to same-gender couples, including second-parent adoption, joint adoption, and medically assisted conception, but not equal marriage rights. Dr. Helmut Graupner is representing the families and says the children deserve the legitimacy that the civil marriages of their parents would bring them. Vienna's child and youth advocate seemed to agree, saying in a statement this week that civil marriages of the parents would ensure that their children's rights are fully respected and help them feel confident about their family stability. Graupner told online news outlet The Local that he expects a ruling in January or February.
But lawmakers in Uganda continued their apparent crusade against sexual minorities with passage on November 26th of a bill that closes foreign aid groups if government officials object to their activities. Human rights advocates warn that the legislation is a less-than-veiled attempt to expel LGBT-supportive non-governmental organizations, NGOs, even though their work often involves HIV/AIDS education. The NGO bill requires all foreign aid organizations to be licensed. A license would be revoked if the NGO has been involved in any act which is prejudicial to the interests of Uganda and the dignity of the people of Uganda. Directors of groups operating without a license could be fined and imprisoned for up to 8 years. The language in the bill seems to be purposely vague and allows the government to virtually expel any NGO it doesn't like. Critics say the new law also opens the door to the persecution of peaceful political opponents.
In other news, lawmakers in Vietnam voted 282-84 on November 24th to allow trans people who've undergone reassignment surgery elsewhere to re-register in their gender of choice. The operation is illegal in Vietnam, so trans people seeking the surgery usually travel to nearby Thailand. Those who qualify will still have to wait until early 2017 before the legislation takes effect. The new law is nevertheless another advance for sexual minorities in the Southeast Asian nation, which boasts a burgeoning and vibrant queer nightlife in its main cities and even bicycling pride processions in Hanoi in recent years. Vietnamese LGBT rights activists are setting their sights now on making gender reassignment surgery legal in the country.
Bolivia's Justice Minister Virginia Velasco Condori issued an administrative order on November 27th allowing trans people to legally change their name and gender designation on official government documents, including IDs and birth certificates. Individuals will need to be psychologically evaluated first, however. It took a while. The action was first proposed 3 years ago by Raisa Toriani, the national coordinator of the Bolivian trans movement.
Updating some previous NewsWrap reports, Mona Iraki, the infamous Egyptian TV journalist who orchestrated a televised raid on a Cairo gay bathhouse last December, was sentenced on November 26th to 6 months in jail for defamation and spreading false news. 26 men, including the bathhouse owner and four employees, were tried for debauchery, but exonerated due to lack of evidence. Iraki remains unrepentant despite worldwide criticism. A lawyer for the men said they intend to sue her for damages in civil court.
And the board of directors of a Rutherford County, North Carolina public charter school has reversed its ban on student clubs 2 weeks after it suspended all of them, including the school mascot-based Raptors for Christ, rather than allow an LGBT student group to meet on campus. A supportive teacher allowed the fledgling lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender club to meet in her classroom. When word got out, most people at a raucous public meeting expressed everything from disapproval to outrage. A news release from the American Civil Liberties Union this week said the board of Lake Lure Classical Academy, which offers classes from kindergarten to high school, voted on November 30th to establish a new policy requiring students up to and including eighth grade to get parental consent to join a student club, but not its high school students. The Associated Press reported that the board will also now require all club posters to have a stamp of approval from the school director and restricts them to designated club bulletin boards in the middle and high school halls.
And finally, cozying up to advocates of executing gay people and the farthest right wing of his party hasn't seemed to hurt GOP presidential hopeful Ted Cruz. In the latest poll of rank-and-file Republicans, the Texas senator has surged to second place in the crowded pack of GOP presidential wannabes, though he's still behind entrenched frontrunner Donald Trump by double digits. In a conference call with conservative activists this week, Cruz called the Supreme Court marriage equality ruling
one of the greatest threats to our democracy we have seen in modern times.
He also condemned President Barack Obama for being
more interested in promoting homosexuality in the military than he is in defeating our enemies.
The senator teetered on parody in the face of tragedy this week, just hours after Robert Louis Deere attacked a Planned Parenthood facility in Colorado Springs, killing three people and injuring nine others.
I think there has been some vicious rhetoric on the left blaming those who are pro-life. We don't fully know the motivations of this deranged individual. We know that he was a man who registered to vote as a woman. You know, the media promptly wants to blame him on the pro-life movement when, at this point, there's very little evidence to indicate that. It's also reported that he was registered as an independent and as a woman and a transgendered leftist activist, if that's what he is.
After Cruz's comments went viral, a spokesperson admitted that the senator's news source had been a right-wing blog. A Think Progress reporter concluded that the voter registration form identifying Deere as female, the only accuracy among Cruz's claims, was probably nothing more than a typo. And a BuzzFeed reporter sent to Deere's hometown of Hartselle, Colorado, spoke with six people who said they knew him and that there was no indication that he might be transgender. One neighbor described Deere as a rough-looking giant dude.
That's News Wrap for the 2 weeks ending December 5th, 2015. Produced by Steve Pride, written by Greg Gordon, and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap from This Way Out is brought to you by you.
Help keep us on the air and in your ears at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast. For This Way Out, I'm Wenzel Jones.
And I'm Tanya Kane Perry.
Is there any escape from the Islamic State?
We had documented over 30 killings in Iraq and Syria in 2015 alone, where ISIS claimed responsibility for killing people for allegedly engaging in acts of lot, what we might, in a more vernacular way, say engaging in sodomy.
We've got a compelling outright international report after this important message.
Hi, I'm NewsWrap reporter Christopher Gall. It's that time of the year again when many of our U.S. listeners consider ways to maximize their annual charitable tax deductions.
And I'm NewsWrap reporter Chris Ann Eastwood. No matter where you are in the world, we need your help. Log on to thiswayout.org to do your part to keep this nonprofit volunteer-based program going.
You'll also find some unique musical, cultural, and historical programming from the This Way Out archives as our way of saying thank you. And those CDs make unique holiday gifts, too.
Please go to thiswayout.org to support our efforts to inform, entertain, and educate listeners around the world. Or postal mail your contribution to P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078 USA.
From the This Way Out family to you and yours, happy holidays.
And thank you.
If you want your thank you gift CDs to make it onto Santa's sleigh, please visit our website soon to make your choices. Facing relentless persecution and grisly executions, LGBT Syrians were trying to escape the self-proclaimed Islamic State even before the overwhelming masses of refugees pouring into Europe began making headlines. As many countries struggle with how to handle the humanitarian crisis and the potential security risks, Canada has announced a policy that will include LGBT people among the 25,000 refugees it will accept. Young single men will not be allowed in, but the government of newly elected pro-LGBT Prime Minister Justin Trudeau is giving single gay men priority status, along with other particularly vulnerable refugees, such as women, children, and families. The plan is not without controversy, since it's difficult to make comparisons between categories of people in desperate situations. This Way Out correspondent Abby Dees spoke with Outright Action International Executive Director Jessica Stern about the issues specific to LGBT refugees.
In the context of this absolutely unfathomable human crisis, which is affecting the Syrian people, it's understandable that we're not necessarily thinking about how particular groups are impacted. But actually, if you want to understand the ways that people are vulnerable and how you can help make them safe, you actually have to think about their identities and behaviors, which means that children don't experience the vulnerability of being a refugee in the same way adults do. It means that people with disabilities experience the challenges of being a refugee differently than those who are able-bodied. And those who are lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, or intersex are experiencing a lack of safety in a way that sets them apart from the broader refugee crisis. Being a refugee is absolutely horrible for everybody, regardless of identity. And within that context of broader deprivation, one of the most important ways you can survive an imperfect and actually failed system is by turning to people that you know. But if the people from your own country don't necessarily want to share resources with you, if they are potential perpetrators of violence, then you can't depend on the traditional informal support systems that other refugees have access to. In the context of LGBTI people from Syria, we know that they're depending on other LGBTI Syrian refugees, but we're not talking about a community that's terribly well-resourced in the face of this crisis. When you arrive in a country where you don't speak the language, then other people from your country are going to be incredibly important. It's very often that we see that a refugee crisis is profoundly gendered. We know that if you have savings, that you're in a better position to flee in the face of a crisis than someone who's been destitute all along. So for queer folks, it's particularly important to think about how gender and how location impact us, because we find that not only are lesbians and transgender people often those left behind, but then within the context of being a refugee, the mechanisms for financial survival are very limited for LGBTI people. And of course, sex work becomes one of the key forms of survival for so many.
What are the particular threats that LGBTQ people are facing in places like Syria?
Anyone living under the domination of ISIS is unsafe. It doesn't matter who you are. But obviously, the things that make you unsafe vary depending on who you are. So ISIS has engaged in a systematic campaign of terror, targeting anyone perceived to be lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, or intersex, regardless of who they actually are, what they've actually done, and what evidence does or does not exist to substantiate the allegations of homosexuality or transgenderism. For the past several years, Outright has been working in a very deep partnership with an Iraqi-based organization working primarily on women's rights and also a U.S.-based women's human rights organization that is a longtime partner of the Iraqi group. And here I'm talking about the Organization for Women's Freedom in Iraq, which is based out of Baghdad, and the organization called Madre, based out of New York. We started looking at the ways that LGBTI people were vulnerable to ISIS through the lens of those living in Iraq. And because of the increasing territorial control of ISIS, we expanded our data to include Syria as well. Based on the last time we updated our numbers, which was mid-September, we had documented over 30 killings in Iraq and Syria in 2015 alone, where ISIS claimed responsibility for killing people for allegedly engaging in acts of lot. So what we might, in a more vernacular way, say engaging in sodomy. And what we've documented, and you can find all of this on our website, outrightinternational.org, is that ISIS has systematically murdered people by pushing them off the rooftops of buildings, by stoning people to death, by shooting people. And more recently, we've been hearing stories from colleagues in Iraq and Syria that some ISIS agents have actually been tying weights around the neck of people they intend to execute for alleged homosexual acts so that they're sure that when they push them off the building, it will be their head that hits the ground first.
Of course, this isn't limited to Syria. It's not limited to Iraq or even ISIS, I would imagine.
Right. When we look at the vulnerabilities affecting LGBTI people around the world, we have to realize that the rise in militia violence makes LGBTI people particularly unsafe. A lot of people are particularly fixated on ISIS, and obviously for good reason, but for those of us that have been trying to work in solidarity with people in Iraq for a long time, what we know is that Iraqi militias were the primary perpetrators of violence against LGBTI people for many years, particularly in very serious and systematic attacks in 2009 and 2012. And in the face of kind of loss of control, the government of Iraq has actually turned to those very same militias to try to help them fight ISIS. So what we're seeing is that whether you're living under ISIS control or you're in some other part of Iraq or Syria, where the government is ostensibly in control, the crisis is having a ripple effect that makes LGBTI people at all levels much more unsafe.
from what you're talking about, it's not over for them once they achieve a refugee status, once they even get into a camp or maybe even get into a country like ours. They are still facing real threats to their safety because of their status.
Yeah, that's exactly right. The anti-immigrant, anti-refugee, anti-Muslim, anti-Iraqi, anti-Syrian hate speech that we've been hearing in the U.S. with increasing volume in recent weeks, recent months, has just shocked the conscience. Because instead of fixating on the few examples where there have been violent acts perpetrated by refugees, we should be looking at the overwhelming majority of refugees who are innocent people fleeing gross violence in their home countries and are looking for safety to rebuild their lives. And I'm aware that Representatives Paulus, Maloney, and Sinema, who are also among the leadership of the LGBT Equality Caucus, voted in support of what we'll call the House of Representatives Bill 4038. I refuse to call it by its public name.
I'll say it for you, the American Safe Act.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it is really about safety. I think it's really about hatred and fear. And for people on the American left that remember the environment after September 11th, we know that this country can turn against the people who are most vulnerable, people who are brown, people who are Muslim, people who speak with accents. And we just can't let that happen again. And the scale and scope of the refugee crisis is so tremendous that it is absolutely the responsibility of every one of us that cares about LGBTI people, that cares about human rights, that cares about justice, to make sure that this country is a place of refuge, a place of safety. And we not only accept a decent number of refugees in this country, but we actively encourage them to come here.
A lot of our listeners are probably thinking, well, okay, I agree. This is terrible. I want to do something. I don't know what to do about the Syrian refugee crisis. What can you tell them?
That's a really hard question, because unless you are very committed to this issue, when you ask, what can I do? You generally mean, what can I do in a small amount of time? And I think it's really important to say, that's okay. You don't have to quit your job to make a difference. You don't have to move to Turkey and start working in a refugee camp to make a difference. But you should do something. And there may be a healthy skepticism among some of your listeners about the impact of the congressional process. I want to say, it is in moments like these, after the recent attacks that we've seen around the world, where members of Congress absolutely must hear from us, to hear that we don't want to move into another era of increased state security apparatus and decreased welcome for those in crisis from around the world. So I would say, if you were ever going to call your member of Congress, if you were ever going to write to your congressperson, if you were ever going to sign a petition to someone in Congress, this is the moment.
It's very old school. You know, we're so used to doing it on social media, and I suppose you can do email, but I still think there's room for picking up the phone or writing a letter and signing it by hand, because those letters do get read. I do know that.
And then I want to make another point, which no one ever loves hearing, but is so important. People who care about refugees should make donations to support refugees. It means direct material assistance, which we all know is absolutely essential. Because if you have to leave everything behind, you need material support to survive. But the second thing is, people should be making donations to organizations that are advocating for the rights of refugees. So any of your listeners that really care about these issues should do some research. They should go online. They should find out which refugee assistance organizations they're most comfortable with. And then they should write a nice check.
Jessica, thanks so much for taking time. I know you've got a lot of work to do, and I really do hope that anytime anything comes up, you always think to give us a ring, and we'll happily have you on the air to share these insights with our listeners. It really means a lot to us.
I'm a huge fan of yours, so thank you very much for this opportunity.
That was the wonderful Jessica Stern, the executive director of Outright Action International. Google them. They're doing really amazing work.
For This Way Out, I'm Abby Dees.
While we've noted that Canada is opening its doors to Syrian refugees and giving special consideration to the plight of LGBT people from the region, the welcome has not been so warm from Canada's neighbor to the south. But U.S. politicians who oppose any resettlement of Syrian refugees may be embarrassed to learn that the Statue of Liberty was based on an Arab woman. The original proposal by its creator, French designer Frédéric Auguste Bartholdi, was for an Egyptian lighthouse at the Suez Canal in the form of a veiled peasant woman. As Daily Beast columnist Michael Daly put it, the Statue of Liberty was born a Muslim. Thanks for choosing This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. This week, Tanya Kane Perry, Wenzel Jones, Christopher Gall, and Chris Ann Eastwood contributed program material, with double thanks this week to Steve Pride. Neil Diamond performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation, the Yavanna Foundation, the estate of Christopher David Trentum, our contributing affiliate stations, and you, our listener supporters, for making this program possible, especially during our year-end campaign. You'll find more information about that, including signing up for modest monthly support amounts, in the All About This Way Out section at thiswayout.org. Email tworadio@aol.com or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappell and the entire This Way Out family, I'm Greg Gordon. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org and on KGHE Alma, Washington, CFRC Kingston, Ontario, WOJB Hayward, Wisconsin, and more than 200 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Against the grain, when we create a binary with humans on one side and what we call nature on the other, what are the consequences for animals, for women, and for other subordinated groups? I'm C.S. Song. We'll re-present a conversation with Barbara Sieber about the human-nature divide, the social hierarchies it fosters, and the work of Mary Wollstonecraft after these news headlines with Eileen Alfandari.
Thousands of employees of San Bernardino County began returning to work today, 5 days after county restaurant inspector Syed Farouk and his wife Tafshin Malik opened fire on a gathering of his co-workers, killing 14 and wounding 21. Members of the Board of Supervisors were there to welcome them. Supervisors President James Ramos said county officials are increasing security at county buildings.
As county buildings are starting to open up, we are looking at additional features for permanency in areas that are out there also.
Can you specify some of the features?
Some of the procedures that we're looking at, we've increased from level one to level three security around the area. We have worked with the Sheriff's Department identifying some of those areas. We're continuing to look at and to hear from the employees what it is that they would like to see that would make them feel safe.
The U.S. Justice Department has opened a probe into patterns of racial disparity in the use of force by Chicago police. Attorney General Loretta Lynch announced the investigation.
We will examine a number of issues related to the Chicago Police Department's use of force, including its use of deadly force, racial, ethnic, and other disparities in its use of force, and its accountability mechanisms.
The announcement comes nearly 2 weeks after the release of a video showing a white Chicago police officer shooting a black teenager, Laquan McDonald, 16 times, killing him. Officer Jason Van Dyke has been charged with murder. But prosecutors said another Chicago police officer will not be charged in the fatal shooting of a 25-year-old black man who authorities said was armed with a gun as he ran away from officers. Officials released a police video that showed the shooting of Ronald Johnson. Police claim Johnson pointed a gun at them before running away. His family had been pressing for release of the video. Democratic presidential candidate Bernie Sanders outlined a plan to cut U.S. carbon emissions by 40% by the year 2030 and 80% by the year 2050 from 1990 levels. The Sanders plan also includes major investments in renewable power and electric vehicles and aid for dislocated workers and vulnerable communities. Sanders said he would seek to impose a tax on carbon pollution. That's a plan advocated by the former top climate scientist for NASA, James Hansen. Sanders said his approach would put people before the profits of polluters. In a statement, Sanders said, quote, "Right now we have an energy policy that is rigged to boost the profits of big oil companies like Exxon, BP, and Shell at the expense of average Americans." Sanders accused oil executives of raking in record profits while climate change ravages our planet and our people. Syria's government said the U.S.-led military coalition carrying out airstrikes on Islamic State had carried out a deadly airstrike on a Syrian army camp. Syria said four coalition jets killed three soldiers and wounded 13 in the eastern Deir ez-Zor province on Sunday evening and called it an act of aggression. It's the first time Syria has charged U.S. airstrikes hit its soldiers. Officials from the U.S.-led alliance denied the report and said Russia was responsible. The NAACP has called a special meeting for tonight on the San Francisco police killing of African-American Mario Woods. Police last week shot him in a hail of 15 bullets after they claimed the 26-year-old refused to drop a knife. A video of the event has gone viral and has prompted calls for San Francisco Police Chief Greg Suhr to resign. In the statement calling for a meeting, San Francisco NAACP President Amos Brown said, quote, "The graphic images of Mario Woods, a clearly troubled young man being shot multiple times by officers, are painful to watch." San Francisco planners estimate up to 1 million visitors may jam the city in the lead-up to Super Bowl 50. Supervisors are holding a hearing today on the expected impacts of the game. I'm Eileen Alfandary. More news headlines at 4. Please join us at 6 for the Pacifica Evening News.
And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. There is, according to a number of important thinkers, a dualism, an insidious dualism that's been at play for a long time, a dualism that pits humans against something we call nature. The critique goes something like this. When humans are set apart from nature, nature suffers. But not just that. Groups constructed as closer to nature, as closer to the nature side of the human-nature divide, are subordinated, and that subordination is legitimized as natural. Today, we explore that perspective through the work of an important British philosopher named Mary Wollstonecraft, about whom my guest Barbara Sieber has much to say. Sieber, an English professor at Brock University in Canada, sees the human-animal relationship as pivotal in the writings of Wollstonecraft. Sieber argues that the 18th century thinker saw the dualisms of human nature, man-animal, and male-female to be fundamentally flawed. Among other things, Sieber poses the question, does the fact that women are treated like objects have any relationship to the fact that animals are treated like objects? Barbara Sieber wrote an essay about Mary Wollstonecraft's insights that appears in the volume Engaging Nature, Environmentalism and the Political Theory Canon. She's also written a book called Jane Austen and Animals. When Barbara joined me via a studio on the Brock campus in St. Catharines, Ontario, I asked her about the kinds of things Mary Wollstonecraft wrote and wrote about.
Well, I think Wollstonecraft is most known for Vindication of the Rights of Woman, which is one of the foundational texts in the history of feminism. But she also wrote many other things. So The Vindication of the Rights of Woman is her most famous political tract, but she also wrote The Vindication of the Rights of Men, which was the first response to Edmund Burke's Reflections on the Revolution in France. Besides these two famous political tracts, she also wrote novels. She wrote educational texts, you know, what we would call young people's literature or textbooks on educating young people. And she also wrote a travel narrative. So one of the things, there are many things that are remarkable about Wollstonecraft, but one of the things is that she worked across genre lines.
And Barbara, how important a figure is Wollstonecraft in and to the history of feminism?
She's very, very important. She, I think, really laid the groundwork for what we consider to be the tradition of feminism in the West. Her ideas, especially around the time of the French Revolution, she really pointed out that when social justice claims were advanced on the part of certain social groups, she really made clear that women were not included in that crucial category of being advanced for rights. So, and that's, I think, why her most famous text is called, you know, The Vindication of the Rights of Woman, that she uses the singular and not the plural, because she's really trying to make the point that the category of the woman has been left out of political thought and political movements, and that women need to be included. So I would say she's foundational.
She's also a significant figure in the history of ecofeminism. And maybe before we get to the critique that ecofeminism has brought forth, we should talk about the environmental ethic and what the key components of this ethic are, which will hopefully lay the foundation for a certain critique of that ethic.
Yes, I mean, ecofeminism, you know, is growing out of what we would broadly call environmental ethics. And again, I mean, I'm talking in very broad strokes here because these are, you know, hugely complex and important issues. But the key points in an environmental ethic are that humans are co-members of an ecological community, so that, you know, it's not just humans, that humans
that it would be wrong to interfere with the stability of an ecosystem. I mean, those are two of the key points of an environmental ethic.
And much of what we'll talk about this hour is a critique of a dualism that's been around for a long time, a dualism that pits humans against nature, that puts into opposition humans on the one hand and nature. Can you talk about this dualism and how it came about?
Well, I think that this dualism of humans versus nature is really foundational in Western philosophy and Western thought. And from an environmental perspective, I mean, it's created a lot of problems because humans feel like they are separate from nature and that nature is, you know, there for them to use in whatever way they see fit. I mean, all it takes is a look at sort of the current environmental crisis that we find ourselves in to see how dangerous the human nature division is. From a feminist perspective, from an ecofeminist perspective, one of the key problems with the human nature dualism is also that it pits certain social groups against each other, so that the human part of that binary is actually associated with ideas like rationality, with transcendence, with the kinds of things that are gendered as masculine in the Western tradition. And then nature, aligned with nature or associated with nature, are social groups like women, but not just women, also children, the poor, you know, those who are less than, those who have less power. So from an ecofeminist perspective, the human nature dualism is bad for nature and for the environment, but it also has deleterious consequences for human relations, because the human nature dualism reinforces certain power relations.
So the human nature divide means, or has meant, that human tends to be associated with masculine and nature tends to be associated with feminine, in the sense that women are considered closer to nature, closer to animals than to the rational aspect that's emphasized about humans?
Absolutely. So that you know, the category of the woman is, you know, if we're thinking about, and I mean, the way I always talk about this with my students is, you know, if we write on a board sort of that binary of human nature, then all sorts of other binaries line up with that. Masculine, feminine, reason versus emotion, the mind versus the body, human versus animal. So that these binaries are connected. And in some ways, the human nature dualism or the human animal binary is foundational to other social hierarchies.
And can those hierarchies include, let's say, people of color, such that they are seen more like, well, we hear the term, for example, in some cases, that a certain kind of person is subhuman. And I guess that would mean that they're associated more, they're seen more as non-human animal than as human.
Absolutely. I mean, that's a really, really important point that you raise there. And I think that one of the key factors that distinguishes ecofeminism from other environmental philosophies is that it really pays attention to social hierarchies. And it's gender, obviously, but it also has to do with racialization, and it also has to do with class. And I think that this is especially true when we're talking about someone like Mary Wollstonecraft, who, you know, was writing at a time when, in terms of the issue of racialization, I mean, she's writing during a time when
there is slavery, right? I mean, there still is slavery, of course, today. But certainly there are humans who are not considered, who are considered subhuman during Wollstonecraft's time. And that applies to gender, it applies to racialization, and it applies to class. And there's a fascinating book by Marjorie Spiegel called The Dreaded Comparison, and it actually makes really explicit how the human-animal binary is connected during the time that England was a slave-owning society, was connected to issues of slavery. And she really draws parallel between how the discourse of species is really connected to the discourse of racialization.
And if we go back to the human nature divide, which ecofeminists would say underpins other social hierarchies, as you've been saying, what would ecofeminists and also animal studies, because you are deeply interested and engaged with animal studies, what position would they take about whether that divide, human on the one side and nature on the other, is a natural distinction or is a distinction created by humans?
Well, I think that from an animal studies perspective, the answer is really clear cut, and the answer is that the category of the animal is a social construction. So an animal studies position would be that species, which again we tend to think of, or many people tend to think of, as just self-evident, right? I mean, you can see it's a human, you can see if it's a dog, right? People think that species is self-evident. An animal studies perspective would suggest that species is as socially constructed as gender, as racialization, or as class identity, that these are social constructs. And I think that, you know, we're living in a really exciting time because there are many, many advances being made in fields like ecology and different research areas that really show that many of the things that we used to consider or that were considered uniquely human, right, that there was something exceptional about the human, that's really open to question, right? The whole idea that, okay, only humans can use tools, only humans have language, only humans are capable of altruism. There's a vast body of scholarship out that really challenges those ideas. And it's really exciting. It's also really destabilizing, of course, because that then really draws into question the way our society is structured, because our society on the whole is deeply invested in the subordination of the animal. But once you say, well, really, like, what makes someone a human versus what makes someone an animal? When you really start unpacking that, it becomes very complex and we lose our certainty. And I think one of the key, you know, foundational texts, Peter Singer's Animal Liberation, which was published in the 70s, I mean, that's really, you know, one of the many points that Singer, you know, the famous philosopher, makes, that what we think of as human is not necessarily self-evident.
I'm CS. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Barbara Sieber joins me. She is professor of English at Brock University in Ontario, Canada. And she wrote an essay about Mary Wollstonecraft's insights into the relationship between human beings and nature and between men and women that appears in the volume Engaging Nature, Environmentalism and the Political Theory Canon. So would you say, Barbara, that arguing that the human-animal divide, the human-nature distinction, that these are socially constructed distinctions or dichotomies, that this would help either ecofeminism or animal studies establish the position that other social hierarchies that derive from that human nature or human-animal dichotomy are also socially constructed, and therefore, you know, if thought in that way, we might be able to change certain things a bit easier?
I think that's the hope. I mean, I think that that really, what you've just articulated there, C.S., I mean, that's the hope. And certainly that's a hope that we find already in Mary Wollstonecraft. And most famously, we find it in her analysis of gender, where she takes what were seen as, you know, self-evident categories, you know, what it means to be a man, what it means to be a woman. Those were seemingly self-evident categories in her day. And in her writing, she shows how masculinity and femininity are products of education. And she talks a lot about, again, what would have seemed natural, quote-unquote, or self-evident, or just the way it is to the readers of her time. And she shows those up as their, I mean, she uses the term their habits or their forms of prejudice. And I think that as soon as you make that switch from it's natural to it is a habit or a form of prejudice, then it opens up, right? It opens up opportunities for change. It creates a space where you can intervene. And so again, going back to one of your earlier questions of how important is Wollstonecraft to feminism, I mean, this is one of the ways in which she's crucial, because to use our, you know, the language of our time period, I mean, she really highlighted the difference between sex and gender.
Now, in this essay, in this volume, Engaging Nature, you specifically look at Wollstonecraft's writings about animals as a gauge of what this woman, this philosopher and writer who was born in 1759 and died in 1797, as a gauge of what she believed about and what she thought about animals and their place in the world and humans' relationship to animals. Can we understand Wollstonecraft's feminism without grasping what she believed about and wrote about animals?
I think that's a really good question, and it opens up a lot. I mean, on the one hand, the simple answer to that is yes, because Wollstonecraft's work has been understood and has received really insightful commentary for many decades now by very perceptive readers who didn't touch the animal issue at all. So on the one hand, absolutely, yes. But on the other hand, and I mean, this is the beauty of literature, it's the beauty of philosophy, it's the beauty of, you know, my job and your job, that things keep evolving, so that certainly the first time I read Wollstonecraft, I didn't pay any attention to the animal references. None. I wrote a book called Jane Austen and Animals. Well, again, even 12 years ago, I never paid any attention to the animal references in Austen's novels. But things change, because we don't read in a vacuum. We don't read texts in a vacuum. So when we read, when we go back to a text, we also bring with us everything else that we read and hear about in our culture. So then we pick up different nuances in these texts. And I would say that the question about the animal, sort of what ethical consideration, if any, is due to animals, what is their place in the world, I would say that now that is a crucial question. I mean, there are theorists like Giorgio Agamben who would say it's the most decisive question. So again, I think we're at a historical moment where that question of what constitutes the human, how do we define the human, how do we define the animal, I would say that's the question, or it's, if we're not going to go that far, it's at least one of the crucial questions. So from where we're located now, historically, in this historical moment, I would say that the animal question is a vital part of Wollstonecraft. But then I would say that, wouldn't I?
So to what extent did Wollstonecraft acknowledge or refer to the ability of animals to feel pain, for example?
She did that a lot. And, I mean, in a lot of her texts, whether you are looking at the texts that she wrote specifically for the education of young people, right up to her travel narrative or her novels, I mean, she talks about, again, what we would call sentience. And again, if we're going back to some of the foundational texts in the animal rights movement, such as Peter Singer's, it goes right back to, you know, can animals, you know, feel pain? And once we acknowledge that, okay, animals can feel pain, not just physical pain, but also emotional pain, if that's acknowledged, then that would call for a radical, I mean, if we really listen to that, I mean, that would call for a radical transformation of the way things are. And Wollstonecraft, in her writing, it comes up over and over again. I mean, that's actually one of the ways, you know, she, in her educational texts, she teaches young people about compassion and wisdom and their place in the world is by relating to animals. So for Wollstonecraft, developing what we would call an ethical system or an ethical sense, she sees the human interaction with animals as crucial to that. And even in The Vindication of the Rights of Woman, again, her most famous text, I mean, she proposes national co-education for both boys and girls, and she actually says that kindness towards animals should be on the curriculum. So she really sees it as an important ethical and political topic, I would argue.
And as you write in this essay, in Vindication of the Rights of Woman, a treatise by Mary Wollstonecraft, she argues that, quote, humanity to animals should be particularly inculcated as a part of national education. And I'm wondering if you could read the paragraph from that treatise that you quote in this book at some length.
Okay. Habitual cruelty is first caught at school, where it is one of the rare sports of the boys to torment the miserable brutes that fall in their way. The transition as they grow up from barbarity to brutes to domestic tyranny over wives, children, and servants is very easy. Justice or even benevolence will not be a powerful spring of action unless it extends to the whole creation. Nay, I believe that it may be delivered as an axiom that those who can see pain unmoved will soon learn to inflict it.
So in other words, she's arguing here, and I think in other places, that men who are boys and men who are cruel to others, including the animals, will not necessarily be kind to females.
Absolutely. Or anyone who is, you know, quote unquote, below them in the social hierarchy. And I mean, I think that, I mean, I'm not familiar, obviously, with the legal system in the U.S., but where I live in Ontario, in Canada, again, I don't know federally, but certainly in the province of Ontario, provincially, if the Humane Society is called into a situation where a domestic animal has been mistreated, they are required to contact family and child services, because it's so widely acknowledged and understood now that cruelty to a domestic animal can potentially, you know, be a sign of cruelty towards humans. So that link that she's articulating in that passage, I mean, that's widely acknowledged in the research on domestic violence. So much so that it's part of legal procedure.
Her name is Barbara Sieber, S-E-E-B-E-R. She is professor of English language and literature at Brock University, which is in St. Catharines, Ontario, Canada. Her books include Jane Austen and Animals, published in 2013, and General Consent in Jane Austen. And we are talking about an essay she wrote about the British philosopher and writer Mary Wollstonecraft that is part of the volume Engaging Nature, Environmentalism and the Political Theory Canon. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. What comparison does Wollstonecraft make between women's position in society and domesticated animals?
I think that the comparison that strikes me that she makes is that she sees that domesticated animals serve a ornamental function. And I mean, Wollstonecraft is writing in the 18th century, which again in Western culture, really one of the things that happened was the rise of pet keeping, which had, you know, a number of effects. But I think she's commenting on the fact that women are domesticated in patriarchy. There's a famous essay by Yi Fu Tuan named Domination and Affection. And he talks about pet keeping as a mixture of cruelty and affection. And that he says that domestication really is the same as domination. And his point about pets, I think that's the point that Wollstonecraft is making when she compares women to being like pets, i.e. they are dependent, they are made small, they serve a purely ornamental function. I mean, she talks in the Vindication of the Rights of Woman that, you know, women are sort of, you know, they're sort of working on their feathers and they jump, you know, from one perch to the next in a gilded cage. So she would share that perspective on that Tuan makes in his book about domestication being the same as domination. And I mean, that's a complicated point because on the one hand, there's a lot of merit to that argument that when pet keeping really developed in the 18th century and still today, I mean, pets are, they're very loved by many people, but they're also extremely vulnerable, right? I mean, all you need to do is you go to your local shelter and you'll see all of the pets that have been given up for many reasons, some good, like the owner passed away, to not good reasons, like I bought a new condo and they wouldn't allow pets. So pets are very, very vulnerable and they're very disposable in our culture. So there is a lot of truth to this idea that domestication is a form of domination. On the other hand, as many have argued, it is also the rise of pet keeping that played an instrumental role to the development of animal rights or animal welfare discourses, because it changed how people related to animals. And again, I think the same holds true today. If you have a cat or a dog or a hamster, there's always that potential, always, that the, you know, I'm going to say love, because that's how I feel about my cat and dog, that the love that you feel for them will develop into an ethical system that encompasses all animals, not just, you know, the two that happen to be living with you. So pet keeping, I think, also always has that potential, and historically it did. It has that potential to really change how people think about animals, that if you grant the ability for your dog to express emotion, that if you really, again, listen to your dog, that might change how you think about animals, period. I mean, unfortunately, it doesn't for a lot of people, right? A lot of people feel tremendous love and care for their pets, but it stops there.
Mary Wollstonecraft also made certain parallels between animals and children. Talk about that.
Well, she saw a connection between them in terms of their ability to feel pain. So when you read her early educational writings, when she, you know, when the the adult figure in the narrative is teaching a young person about, you know, don't harm this bird, or, you know, don't harm this insect. The adult voice will say, you know, if you harm this bird, it will hurt the bird as much as if I were to harm you. And so there's something slightly sinister about that, of course. And that's what a lot of critics have picked up on. And I think that's also why a lot of people have argued that Wollstonecraft's attitudes towards the human-animal relationship is more conventional and conservative, because when you read those moments, it does seem to inscribe this hierarchy of adults over humans that lines up with a binary between humans and animals, and then you've got adult versus the child, where that the adult voice sort of has this position of power over the child. And I mean, certainly that's a valid reading of those passages, but I would argue that there's also something else going on in those passages, because they also assert that animals feel pain. And again, that's a profoundly important claim. I mean, in the 18th century, that's still a claim that's radical. And you know, we still haven't really caught up to that claim now. Again, people will acknowledge that their pets feel pain, but most people do not extend that to all animals in general. I mean, if they did, we wouldn't have factory farming, right? So that claim that animals, like children, will feel pain, I think is hugely important. And Alan Richardson, who's written really perceptively on Wollstonecraft, also points out that the relationship between adults and child figures in Wollstonecraft is also more complicated, because Wollstonecraft does not believe that relationship is automatically hierarchical. She doesn't assume that a child always owes an adult respect or trust, or that the adult is always right. So again, Wollstonecraft is also very profoundly critical of family structure. And it's not a given in Wollstonecraft that just because an adult says something, that it's right. So I think that equation of children and animals, on the one hand, can seem to reinforce a certain hierarchy, but I think it's more complicated than that.
Barbara Sieber, professor of English at Brock University in Ontario. We'll take a short break and return and speak more with her. Please stay with us. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Barbara Sieber teaches English at Brock University in St. Catharines in Canada. And her books include Jane Austen and Animals, published in 2013. She wrote an essay about the British philosopher Mary Wollstonecraft's insights into the relationship between humans and nature in general, and animals in particular, and between men and women, that is part of a volume called Engaging Nature, Environmentalism and the Political Theory Canon, published by the MIT Press. We have links to Engaging Nature, to Jane Austen and Animals, and to Barbara Sieber's faculty page at Brock University on our webpage, againstthegrain.org. Mary Wollstonecraft also wrote travel narratives. How does she tend to represent animals in these writings?
Well, I found the travel narrative really fascinating, because I think in that narrative, in her letters written during a short residence to Norway, Sweden, and Denmark, she imagines a different way of relating to animals. When you read her narrative, she sees these opportunities of connection that are really quite striking. A lot of critics have commented on how Wollstonecraft's travel narrative plays with the traditional dynamics of travel writing, where you have a rational, detached, i.e. masculine observer commenting on what he sees, and that this nature or this other part of the world is sort of reduced to an object status. And a lot of critics have commented that when you read Wollstonecraft, she doesn't do that. She really dismantles that binary of subject and object. She immerses herself in the natural environment. And my contribution to those readings is to look specifically at the animal, the representations of animals. And so I would argue that she dismantles the binary between humans and animals in many parts of her travel writing.
So in other words, her habit of immersing herself in the natural environment, or her representation of herself as being immersed, means certain things about how she sees her relationship with animals, with other sentient beings out there?
Yes, that she acknowledges a kinship with animals, and also that she acknowledges that, you know, nature, to use that, you know, that cliche, is not a book for her to read, that there are parts of nature that are inaccessible to her. And there's an episode that I talk about in my essay where she is in a small boat and she observes these starfish in the water, and she looks at them in the water, and then she uses a ladle to lift them out because she wants to look at them more closely and see what they're quote-unquote really like. And that passage is really commenting on rationalist inquiry. It's commenting on scientific inquiry, right? Remove the thing from its environment, observe it, sort of break it down into these identifiable parts. And she really plays with that, because what happens when she lifts the starfish out of the water is that it changes. It's not really the starfish anymore, and it withholds itself. So I think she's also really commenting here on the limits of human understanding and the limits of rational inquiry. And she gives animals agency, that they are not just these passive objects that we can dissect and sort of look at, that they are agents. And again, that's really important.
Getting back to the issue of cruelty to people and then possibly to animals, did Wollstonecraft believe that people who were downtrodden were more likely to treat animals badly, and then perhaps also women?
I make this point in the essay that she didn't perceive animal cruelty not just happening from the top down, that she also saw people who are victimized trying to exert some kind of power over others, and that in some cases that might mean animals, that those would be, so that sometimes the most downtrodden would then also inflict cruelty onto animals.
I want to get back to ecofeminism as maybe a school of thought, and I know obviously there are differences among different ecofeminist thinkers. But there has been a claim, I guess by some people within ecofeminism, that women can and should play a special role in creating a kind of ecological consciousness, in emphasizing and propagating a certain connection between humanity and nature. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, that's very fair to say. I think this is one of the real points of contention within ecofeminism. And it speaks to one of the potential dangers. So I think that some ecofeminists would posit that women have, as you say, sort of a special role in healing humanity's relationship to nature, that somehow women are closer to nature through their own, you know, biological role. And as many critics, including other ecofeminists from other, you know, camps, have pointed out, that that is potentially dangerous because it can put women back into that essentialist argument that excluded women in the first place. So by saying that, okay, women have this special affinity with nature and animals, and they have to use that to try to repair, you know, the world's ecology, that's potentially problematic because it reinforces that old essentialist claim that put women on the side of nature and animals, and hence not rational, hence they can't be full citizens, etc. So there is that danger. Victoria Davison, she makes a distinction between what she calls ecofeminine, so ecofeminine positions, which she defines as those who claim a biological connection between women and nature and celebrating it, and social constructionist positions. So those positions that would argue that the connection between women and animals, that they would historicize that and say that women, historically speaking, have been positioned as closer to nature and animals, and thinking through that. And so I would argue Wollstonecraft belongs to that latter camp of the social constructionist perspective. And I think we see that in her writing, because when you look at her early educational writings, yes, she has, you know, boys being cruel to girls, and to animals, but she also has girls being cruel to animals. So I don't think that Wollstonecraft is saying that there's something innate about women's closeness to the animal world. Not at all. So I think she is definitely a social constructionist, and I would define myself as a social constructionist also.
Barbara Sieber is professor of English at Brock University in Ontario, Canada, and we're discussing an essay she wrote about the British philosopher Mary Wollstonecraft and her insights into the relationship between humans and nature, and humans and animals, and between men and women. And this essay appears in a volume called Engaging Nature, Environmentalism and the Political Theory Canon. It's edited by Peter Canavo and Joseph Lane Jr. And I'm reading from this essay here, Barbara. Discussions of animals within environmentalist ethics focus on species preservation and the wild, and overlook the lives of individual animals and domesticated animals. If that's true, what has that kind of focus provoked ecofeminists to say?
Well, it has provoked one of the key points of the ecofeminist critique of some strains of environmental thought, because ecofeminists have pointed out that environmental discourses often focus on the preservation of species and focus on animals in the wild rather than domesticated animals, and ecofeminists have argued that that bias towards species preservation and the wild animals reinforces other biases. That if we go back to that list of binaries on the blackboard, another binary that's connected to human versus nature is wild versus domesticated, that wild animals are privileged over the domesticated animals. And what's problematic about that is that it reinforces a certain masculinist ideology about wildness over domestication, and that it overlooks the billions of animals that are living
in factory farms, that it sort of overlooks them.
And let's go back to a point you made pretty much at the beginning of the hour as a way of beginning to wrap up our conversation. And the point you made and that ecofeminists have made is that women's subordination is rooted in a kind of ideology of women's proximity to the natural realms, females' association with the natural realm, with nature, rather than the rational or masculine realm, which is often a stand-in for human. So you have the human-nature divide, and so then you have women being associated with nature and therefore being subordinated as nature is subordinated in the human-nature divide. We have, of course, been talking about Mary Wollstonecraft, who died, you know, before the 18th century was over. Are you saying that Wollstonecraft advanced this particular critique within the ecofeminist tradition?
I am. That's exactly what I'm trying to argue. And I would argue that Wollstonecraft is not alone in that. I think one of the things that's happened is that the history of these ideas is slowly, you know, being recovered. That I think it's really important to look at the history of environmental thought, at the history of animal welfare and animal rights discourses, because I think what's important is recognizing the continuities as well as the differences. I'm not suggesting that Mary Wollstonecraft is exactly the same as a contemporary ecofeminist philosopher, but I am saying that there are points of similarity. And I think we live in a culture that's really invested in silencing that history. And by silencing the long history of environmentalist thought, ecofeminist thought, animal rights thought, I mean, that sort of disempowers those political positions. I mean, you see it all the time, the way vegetarianism, just to pick one example, is depicted in mainstream culture. It's depicted as a trend, as a fad, but it's not. I mean, those ideas have been around for a long time. So I think that it's important politically to see the longevity of those ideas. And I think it's also important intellectually to know where our contemporary ideas about the environment and about animals, where they come from.
I also want to refer back to your discussion about pets and, you know, the animals that we love and that we want to protect. And you have pointed in your writings to our culture's disconnection between, on the one hand, those kinds of animals, and on the other, the billions of animals in factory farms and in laboratories who have been made largely invisible. So how important is it to you to highlight this disconnection?
I mean, to me, it's extremely important for, I would say, three reasons. I mean, the first reason is that the lives of those billions of animals matter. Those lives in factory farms, I think that it's an accurate to describe those lives as lives of torture is, I think, accurate. So the fact that billions of them are living like that is important. We have to acknowledge that and do something about that. Secondly, I mean, this is not a ranked list, but another reason it's important to look at that disconnection is the environmental consequences of agribusiness. Jonathan Safran Foer's Eating Animals makes that point in a very persuasive and compelling way. And because he's such an excellent writer, he's reached a really broad audience. I mean, he was on Ellen, and he cites, you know, a lot of really compelling, you know, objective evidence, like the UN report on climate change, which, you know, cites that factory farming is one of the largest contributing factors in climate change. So it's, we have to think about those animals who are invisible for the animals themselves. We have to think about them in terms of the environment, the planet as a whole, And then the third reason I would say is going right back to that passage that I read out from Wollstonecraft, that if we are okay with turning a blind eye to the reality of those animal lives, it's going to blunt our ability to empathize with others. And those others can be human or they can be non-human. So I think it's vitally important.
That's Barbara Sieber, English professor at Brock University in St. Catharines, Ontario. The chapter she's written about Mary Wollstonecraft appears in the volume Engaging Nature, Environmentalism, and the Political Theory Canon. Barbara is also the author of Jane Austen and Animals. And this is Sia, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, and we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources and links, and a way to sign up for our podcast. Yes, that has been restored. You can go now to againstthegrain.org and sign up for our podcast. You can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio, and you can follow us on Twitter at Radio Against. Many thanks to Lucrecia Burton, who's at the controls today.